You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the mysteries. The very highest degrees of which, combined together, make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 30th of May 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom, close by Bristol city centre. And don't believe a word we say. We do our best to share a few flashes of clarity from this Templar port down here in Bristol, turned merchant venturer fortress, in Tampon Charlie's empire of lies. But you have to go and check things for yourself. That's the way it works, I'm afraid, folks. So although you'll see written all over the BBC how true they are, you've got their BBC Verify pretending to verify things. But we say the opposite. Don't believe a word. Go and check it for yourself. And you can check quite a lot of what we're talking about, any of the more contentious stuff, because I put all the links up over the weekend. So usually by Monday, you'll find anything you think, no, I don't believe that. Wow, that's ridiculous, impossible. You can go and check it by the end of the weekend. So we're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, on DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. And by far the best place to get it these days is the link which I've put up on the pinned it to the Telegram channel, the Tony Gosling censored Telegram channel, and also on the show page at thisweek.org.uk, a nice little link just underneath the big green download button. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust psyops, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions and boring us to tears most of the time with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentiers. And we had a good chit chat yesterday on the Richie Allen show, Richie and I, about leadership and about how these numpties, the cowards and control freaks, seem to be being put in charge of everything, and all the decent people, natural leaders on their way to the top, get cancelled. Funny that, isn't it? That's a good way of destroying a country. Anyway, it's not the end of the world, or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also joining me in the studio are local residents from housing associations, Emma Reynolds and Julius Abrahams. Well, let's start with you first, Julius. You just live literally at the end of the street here.
Yes, I do.
And how long have you lived in your property, and what was it like in there?
I moved in October 1998. My housing association is Places for People, and I was so happy when I got my place. So I was at uni and I was renting.
Was it here in Bristol?
Private renting. So yeah. I used to live in Harlow, Essex, and I came here for university, then I stayed here.
You like Bristol?
Yeah, hence why I stayed.
I did.
Yeah.
Who's your landlord? Who's your social landlord?
It's Places for People.
Right, well, they're one of the biggest in the country, I think,
yeah.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
Anyway, so tell us about your experiences with them. How did you get on with them?
So, really happy that I moved in, and one of the things that I didn't really like is when you're on the housing list, when your name comes up, they say, right, we're going to show you three properties. If you don't choose any of them, you're going to go basically. You've got to start again. They showed me one property, basement flat. I said, no, I don't like basement flats. Second property, basement flat. Didn't like it. Third one, I said, that's not fair. I said, you keep showing me basement flats. They said, okay. So then the next one they showed me, the entire block was empty. The basement, the first floor, second floor, and then the top floor. And I chose the first floor because I didn't want to haul my furniture all the way up the top, but I did like the view. So I was really happy when I moved in. And then I think 2006. So I write stand-up comedy. I was also working for Hewlett-Packard. I worked for Motorola. And in between these jobs, I was trying to write comedy. So I was in my living room. I kept on falling asleep. And I thought there was something wrong with me. I thought I had lethargic something or other. Turned out that there was the flu was blocked and I was being gassed.
So they hadn't done any checks on that. This is carbon monoxide.
Yeah, I was being.
So that's very easy to check for. They could even put a carbon monoxide detector in your place, and then you'd see it was very dangerous. People die of this.
Yeah, a few years ago they put one in, but yeah, then they didn't do any checks.
So how did you find out that that was what was causing it?
So they came eventually a few years later to check, do the gas check. They condemned it, and they put. And it was like, you know, when there's an accident or anything, they put police tape up. They took the heater out, sealed up all the pipes, and just put tape across it. I said, that's unacceptable. Number one, you've nearly ended my life. And number two, you've made my place look horrible. You've just taken the unit out and they gave me nothing else.
So what's it?
They didn't replace
the
unit. Yeah, I had central heating, but I didn't have the gas fire.
Which you need in those big flats, don't you?
Yeah, because it had single pane window, and I do really respect grade 2 listed buildings, keeping the architecture and things like that. So, but there must be a way of insulating a home, bringing it up to the 21st century, without damaging the decor. And I had single pane, it was freezing, absolutely freezing, and I was spending so much on heating. So I complained, I said, I'm going to go to the media about you guessing. And all of a sudden, you can choose whatever electric heater. So I chose a really expensive one, so I got a really nice one in my living room. But then I was a little bit naive about legality. I could have sued them.
Yeah.
Then the cracks started to appear, the cupboards and everything, because we pay a kind of a maintenance
service charge.
So we pay a little bit more on our rent for them to upkeep. And then when I looked at the housing law, they're meant to be proactive in making sure things are up to date, and they weren't doing that. So I showed them that. Then all of a sudden, a few years later, they started updating things. So yeah, they're always behind. It's just all they want to do is it seemed like to collect the rent. At the present, I've got massive cracks, mold. They've eventually changed the windows now, but that was only a few years ago. They have also fitted a new door system. And when they were exchanging the door system over, they left the front door open. I couldn't lock it. So myself and my fiance, we moved out because the fear of people just coming in, and people did come in. It's up to people what they do. But we found people doing their thing on our doorstep, leaning back. Oh, the door's open. So they had access to our place. Yeah. I kept on complaining. Eventually, they've put this door.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a street drinking area. This round here, it's actually a very druggy area too.
Yeah, that's
where we are in St Paul's.
And, I was being very.
So you know, what you do is you do get people just sitting anywhere in the evening. Sometimes even shooting up in our car park, for example.
Yeah.
So it's the sort of area where you do have to be a little bit aware of security.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what's happened about that, leaving the door open? Have they done anything? Have they actually given you a proper key now?
Eventually. So I said the door doesn't lock. I said it's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So they called Avon Electrics. They came. They said, this is not our system. It's half of one, half of another. It was ridiculous. Eventually, they've fitted the door. So that electromagnetic door. So it bangs. But there's no letterbox. And the key system, so I'm flat C. On the key system, to ring my flat, 1, 2, 3. So it doesn't even tally up. Yeah, fair enough, you can work out that A is 1, B is 2, and C is 3. But no one's
I'm laughing, but you've got a guest, or someone coming along, a visitor, that they've got to sit there, basically, they've got to, it's like the Krypton factor.
Yeah.
They've got to figure out, now, what am I do now? And they could be there for 20 minutes pressing buttons and getting nowhere and walk away.
Many people can't operate it. The local councillor came to look at it. He couldn't work out how to ring the bell. Abdul. No. I've had elderly relatives. They can't work it out. It's completely un-user-friendly, isn't it, Jules?
Yeah, because you wouldn't know that there are 4 flats there or 5 flats. So you won't think, oh, A is 1, B is...
Because they haven't marked the front door. They've just put the number. I wonder if
whoever's installed this system and is maintaining it are somehow mates with somebody at Places for People, rather than someone's done some diligence and said which is a good door entry system. The other thing is, of course, this is the fire people mainly, isn't it? Because they are in charge of the doors. They want to make sure that the doors are very, very secure in case of a fire.
Yeah.
In fact, doors to such an extent that sometimes they're really easy. You've got to lean and push and push and push to get the thing open.
You've hit the nail on the head. When I said, why are you not giving us a letterbox, they said somewhere in Scotland there was someone who didn't like someone, and so they put a firework through the letterbox. So not giving you a letterbox will prevent that. I said, that's ridiculous. I've lived here since 1998. I know lots of my neighbours. Not once have I heard that as something that has happened. Lots of other things, but that, no.
Emma, do you want to chip in here? Because I know you've had problems with this door entry system. You're also a Places for People person.
Yeah, I did ask them for the stats on firebombs through letterboxes, but obviously they ignored me. Yeah. We've all been putting formal complaints. So basically,
can you not just cut a hole in the door?
I mean, technically,
it seems to be the obvious thing to do. Yeah. Steel, is it?
Steel. Heavy. Yeah.
Maybe just remove the door.
Electromagnetic.
So, basically, if they had Places for People had a lot of money for upgrades, and it's been a traumatic battle, this whole experience. So, the upgrades were for St. Paul's to have new kitchens and new bathrooms. And I had to fight to get that because inaccurate dates were being given, where I was being told, you've been upgraded in 2015. And I was like, well, I must have taken a lot of acid that day because I don't remember you fitting a new kitchen. I had to fight. I had to threaten to go to the BBC. I had to say, I've known everyone that has lived here since 1991. No one has put a new kitchen in.
So this is a way that housing associations can just fake where they've done improvements so that they can say, oh, well, we don't have to bother looking after this flat
anymore. It seems that way. Obviously, they didn't say they said to me, oh, we had dates mixed up. Then the bathroom wasn't done. They weren't going to do that, but luckily my housing officer stepped in because my bathroom hadn't been done since 1991 either, and they're meant to do it every 30 years. So none of us knew that we were going to get these doors, which are, you know...
So they just turned up, did they?
Well, we were told...
I got a letter the day before saying that it's ridiculous, and the letter wasn't dated. So that's how they get
because
through things.
And it went through the letterbox with the last letter through.
Yes. So in our tenancies, we have a right to consultation.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't appear to us to
Well, it could
been...
be like a 12-hour consultation. If they've posted something through the last thing through the letterbox. You've got 12 hours to look at it before they come in and put a big steel door on that you can't get through.
In my understanding, a consultation isn't just telling you we're going to do something and then doing it, but I'm not a lawyer. I can't afford a lawyer. I'd love to get a lawyer to tell me what does a right to consultation actually mean, because we don't feel we've experienced it other than, yes, we got to choose what colour cabinets for our kitchen, yes, for our bathroom, but for all the communal areas, there has been, in my experience, no consultation. And also, one of my neighbours said, actually, I don't want this prison door without a letterbox. So he got a letter saying, you've been obstructing vital works, we're now going to fine you. You know, this is how they consult us. I've got a lot to say. It's been horrific.
Well, we'll be hearing a bit more from you, I'm sure. But maybe just one by one. Mm-hmm. Julius, what do you think is actually driving this? Is it incompetence? Is it malice? Is it some sort of weird regulation that you've not been told about? What was going on?
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of kind of, it seems to me like some kind of backhand thing, because the when you ring my bell, it goes to my phone now. It only rings a few times, and then it goes to France. You can't leave a message. And if you ring the France number back, it costs you £1.50 per minute. And if you're not familiar with it, cause I think one of my neighbours rang the number. He's like, oh, let me ring
this. £10,
fine. Yeah, £10 for just being on the phone for a little while. So it's a little bit weird.
It sounds like a scam.
Yeah, yeah. It seems very
weird. And what about your relations with places for people? Emma's mentioned the housing office, so that's supposed to be the first point of call, isn't it?
Yeah. So my housing officer is, I think his name is, am I allowed to say his name? Yeah, Gareth Davey.
Cardi,
that's it, sorry, yeah. Gareth Cardi. He's trying his best, but when you're in a bureaucratic system and you're trying to do good, it's very, very hard. Because
and they've moved him on, Jules. He isn't our housing officer now.
Right. I messaged him the other day and he says, I'm really sorry to hear about that. And he said, I will forward this on to... So even though he's not in the position, he's trying to do his best.
He's a really good
man.
He's a good man.
One of the things... So my fiancé's mum bought us a holiday to Turkey. She felt that her daughter, my fiance, was getting a little bit down managing the children and everything. So we had we needed a passport for Eli, and she needed to renew hers. The passports came. Postman couldn't work out. Passports are gold. You can't just put them through the letterbox. They got returned to sender. Then the relationship to my fiance.
What letterbox?
Yeah, what letterbox, exactly.
So they tried to ring the intercom and couldn't.
So
they couldn't
just
get
looked
you the
at
passport.
The intercom, couldn't work it out.
Yeah.
The postman. So it got returned to sender. Then my fiance's mum is ringing us saying, look, if you're not going to go, I want my money back. I spent about $3,000 on you. So we're in this. The relationship between her and her mum was strained.
That's your housing association's responsibility, surely.
Yeah.
So what we didn't explain is that initially they wanted the postman to have 5,000 fobs to walk around St. Paul's with. Postmen weren't keen on that. So they've been given a code, one code for the whole of St. Paul's, which they tap in, stepping over drug addicts waiting, tapping it in full view of the street. So that's how they're meant to get in. Just to explain.
So are they now doing that with letters? They've got some code to get through the door.
So I believe the postmen have got a unique code. It's very, very long. One of the postmen did explain it to me. It's extremely long. How they're meant to keep all these different codes, I don't know. But the system they had before was too easy to work out.
How do you mean?
It was a few numbers.
Oh, okay.
And you could easily work. Because when they fitted the door, was just the year of when they fitted the door. That's it. Four digits. And when you press it in, anyone from the street could see.
And they still can.
Yeah.
Very easily.
So this also is... So there is a sort of another agenda here, in a way. And that is that it's much better to use electronic methods, that the post is not the way to do things. The idea is just get on your email. Don't think about sending a postal letter. That's the way you're supposed to do it nowadays.
Yeah, well, that's a bit ridiculous. Birthday cards, congratulations cards.
Deliveries. They can't be personal cards to say, we missed you.
Yeah.
No, that's right. No, of course not. No.
So we were having Amazon stuff. So I had a little mat for my son to play on and another mat for when he's in the high chair and food goes down, so we don't want it to get on the carpet, all left outside. Anyone walking past, they're not going to know it's a mat. They're just going to take it. And that's $18.99. That's over £36, £37. I've paid for something that could get stolen.
So what happened with the holiday anyway? I'm fascinated. This is, I mean, it's a great, lovely opportunity. Ruined by your housing association.
Yeah.
So what happened?
3 days before we were meant to go, they turned up. We had to go that extra mile. So I had to go to the post office. It was shut that day because it was Saturday, Sunday. I then went back on Monday and luckily it was still there and the guy gave it to us. They had all identification and everything.
Right.
But yeah, places for people would have messed that up.
Yeah, amazing. So anyway, before we hear a bit more from you, Emma, let's have a listen to a news report, because you are not the only people all over the country. There's been a 500% increase in the use of the Housing Ombudsman. So something's been going on over the last 5 or 10 years, and actually just over the last few years, with these housing associations. They are being weaponised against their tenants and against their residents.
That first smile, that first laugh.
Hello.
Parents' phones are filled with videos like this. But as Akram's mum filmed her baby boy, she feared something wasn't right. The mould and damp in his North London home seemed to her too much for his little lungs. She clings to them now, like the onesie her son wore the day before he died, on February the 21st.
It has his cell, you know.
He was 15 weeks old.
He was happy, happy, happy boy. He was a blessing. It was hard to breathe there, to be honest. Even for normal, even for healthy person, not a baby. Before he died, I went there to the GP. But the doctor told me he will grow out of it. She said, you don't need to worry, he will grow out of it. His eyes rolled up. And something white came out of his mouth, so he couldn't respond anymore.
This is where Akram spent his short life. His mum, dad, brother and sister, in a damp, mouldy, one-bedroom flat owned by Housing Association Notting Hill Genesis. An official cause of death will not be determined until an inquest in August.
Are you convinced that your son died because of the state of that flat?
Yes, because of mold and damp. Now we start complaining for a long time, over five years.
Notting Hill Genesis told us they're deeply saddened by the tragic loss of Akram and extend their sincere condolences to his family. They say it is a complex situation and are working with the relevant authorities while they conduct their investigations. They say it would be inappropriate to comment or speculate before the coroner has determined a cause of death. For more than 4 years, ITV News has been investigating the shocking state of some homes owned by councils and housing associations across the country. Families forced to live in barely believable, totally unlivable squalor. And in that time, complaints by tenants have soared. In March 2020, England's Housing Ombudsman, which deals with disputes between residents and landlords, investigated just over 1,100 repair complaints about social housing providers. In March this year, that number had risen to just over 6,300, a jump of 474% in 5 years.
Work of ITV News has had a significant impact on residents and their confidence to raise issues. Tenants simply won't be fobbed off now. Whereas in the past, there was a kind of attitude of get back in your box almost. You should be grateful for the accommodation that you have.
But even when families do speak up, they don't always feel like they're heard.
So that's the excellent ITV News, who seem to be the best in the country, really, at covering many of these housing issues, which is why they're one of the most popular television news services in the country. They're talking there about the death of a child, Emma. Deeply saddened, they say. We extend our condolences. But they didn't actually do anything for what the guy was implying there, about 5 or 7 years, when even though the damp and mould had been reported. So this seems to be a similar sort of attitude by these landowners. And we're supposed to be told that the social housing is somehow different to the private landowners.
Yeah, I mean, it is different in that it's more secure, and that's a really brilliant thing to have. And I do still feel really lucky to have this after years of private renting. But I have seen a decline, like in the last 5 years, like you say. My new housing officer, not even allowed her phone number, not allowed an email. Have to just call the call centre. The old person I had a relationship with, he was a human being.
Yeah.
And when I first moved in, it was even better, 16 years ago. They actually came and spoke to you. You could call them. They helped you. And now it's like a system that's almost designed just to wear you down so that you give up in the end.
It's being dehumanised, yes. Julius. It sounds to me like it's being slowly dehumanised.
Yeah, I would second what you're saying. Yeah, housing officer You're meant to have like a key housing officer, so you can tell them your issues, your problems, and then they will go and deal with them or find the right channels, but they don't even check upon you.
I mean, you didn't even know that you've got a new housing officer.
No,
you
didn't.
Thought it was still Gareth.
They don't tell you anything. They don't tell you anything. No, I mean, my landlord is Live West, is also a housing association. We've been having fun and games with them recently because they've had this astronomical increase in the service charges over the last 2 or 3 years, up to around about 5-6 times what it was.
Wow.
3 or 4 years ago. I mean, just enormous. And just looking at it, you can see what they're doing. They're only allowed to increase the rent a certain amount.
Mm.
But the service charge, if they can argue that, oh, well, there's new requirements,
mm-mm,
then they can up that any amount they want. So they've just decided to do this as a revenue earning thing. Is, well, let's just double the service charge.
I used to work for Live West.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and they it was 21,000. And I was like a service maintenance person because they've got those big vans, haven't they? Yep. And each and every service person has one of those vans, and it's equipped with loads of stuff, and you can order stuff. If you believe that the hedges are overgrowing, you can trim those back. Fair enough, all these things need being done, but that's excessive. Each and every one of us had a van. They've got a fleet of them.
And so they can do anything, that's the idea.
And also, do they break down the cost? Because I've seen people that have got huge electrical costs, and you're thinking, on what planet can just this light switch in the
hall? You know what, you're saying exactly what our complaint... Yeah. We've got some complaints into the Housing Ombudsman at the moment about this, in that they don't let you compare year by year. They don't break down the cost.
Nope.
They'll just say electricity.
Yep.
So you think, well, what electricity is that? You've obviously got some sort of nuclear power station that you're running with this electricity supply. And the latest game they're playing with us is the... Well, 2019, we had a very horrific fire next door where there was an arsonist living in the house, and for about a year, various people have been complaining in that block about him and saying, look, this guy, you know, he's trying to set fire to the place. Can you please get rid of him? Do something. Please, please, please. No, 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 they can't. It's mental health issues, and, you know, he's under treatment. It's all under supervision.
Mm.
And then he drops more flaming material down the staircase to the bottom. And eventually he actually set fire to his entire flat, which burnt the most of that block down and
nearly
killed 8 people. So... this was an obvious warning,
to that.
This is in Cave Street in Bristol. Mm. You can look up the report. The fire engine turned up. It was a big hoo-ha. And so their latest wheeze, after having to close that block and refurbish it for 18 months and then let people come back.
And him come back.
And no, he's not back. He's in apparently better accommodation. The police were around this saying, we desperately want to get him in prison, but the Crown Prosecution Service won't let us because it's just a mental health thing. Because he's done it before, apparently.
Yeah.
And so anyway, the police were hamstrung as well by the system. So the latest wheeze by our Live West is they want to withdraw all of our fire extinguishers.
Right. Withdraw them?
We're no longer allowed to have fire extinguishers because, would you like to guess why they've said that
you might trip on them and die?
That's not far off. Junius, go on.
I think you told me.
Yeah, okay. So the answer is that we're not trained to use a fire extinguisher.
Yep.
So therefore, it's dangerous to have fire extinguishers around the house. So this is reminding me a little bit of the poor chaps at Grenfell Tower who were complaining for about 18 months, saying this the only thing that's going to get them to do anything is this place burns down. And, of course, the rest of it is history.
Yeah.
So, again, this is all going to the housing. Now, I try to drill down into now is what is going on? Why are these... Maybe, Martin, do you want to come in here? Because why is it that these housing associations that were supposed to be like almost like council running, you know, the sort of private version of councils, they now seem to be becoming predatory... like private landowners, and obviously, listen, it's obvious what the fire extinguisher thing is about. They don't just simply want us to die, although they don't care whether we do. They probably get the insurance money rather than the rent instead, so that doesn't bother them too much. But the point is, it's cost cutting, you know, because they've got to go and check them once a year. You know, they've got to go and see if there's any stuff in them, and this is cost cutting. So what is it that's going on with housing associations? Why is it that they're now behaving much more like private landowners and landlords in the last 5 years or so?
Well, I mean, they've gradually, because you were on the board, weren't you, of Knightstone?
When it, before it became Live West, yeah.
That's right. So, in other words, at one stage they were more kind of socially oriented, and they've just become essentially private companies, and they have to raise their own, you know, in your block, for example, there's one bit at the end where they rent it out to, it's essentially private tenants, isn't it? So they're getting money in from doing that. And, of course, the whole point...
Called shared ownership, that section, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, what the point is that instead of being there... I mean, the councils used to provide council housing for people in need on the basis of need. They have now become separate. You know, I mean, Bristol is one of the few cities where we've still got substantial council housing. I was working at the council when...
Some of it's really good, actually.
Well, some of it's not so good as well, because...
I was in one of the tower blocks the other day. They've got a lovely room on the ground floor, which is a communal place where everyone meets for lunch once a week and a chit-chat. Mm. And there's little signs up in the lift say, you know, every Wednesday, and one of the residents comes and sorts it out for them. So, you know, I feel like I'm jealous of the council tenants a bit.
Well, what happened is at one stage they consulted the council tenants and said what they really wanted them to do was to agree to be a housing action trust, you know, so that they would all be pushed into the third sector, towards the private sector. But the council tenants said, no, we don't want that. And so that all the political parties on the council said that they accepted that, including the Conservatives. And I actually put up a little thing because I was working in the social economy section of the council. I put, this third sector stuff isn't always the answer. I mean, we used to have in this country on 65 proper council housing, which was actually, everybody knows who's in charge.
Why is it the housing market? Okay, why is it the housing market is becoming so crazy? I just wanted to share with you some news this week about some small, I think they were in Devon somewhere, a small house builder. They built quite a large estate, about 200 homes. They've just gone bankrupt because they can't sell the homes that they built. So the price seems to be a bit inflated and people can't afford to buy them.
Well, at a certain point, there's going to be a housing crash, isn't there? That's what happened before.
Apparently, the banks have now taken on, and the banks are considering just letting out the houses.
Yeah.
The bank probably rather likes that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's happened is, you know, the most council housing in this country was built in the 1950s under a Conservative government, Macmillan government. And, of course, everybody across the spectrum accepted that there was going to be... I mean, poor people can't afford to buy their houses. If you're going to have a hierarchical system where some people earn a lot less than others, at least a third of the population are never going to be in a position to buy a house. So, of course, the council houses were there to create a floor for everybody. And, of course, it made the housing prices for people who were buying houses lower because you've got a choice, you know. I mean, half my family would be in council housing and the other half would buy their own houses because it just depended, you know, it depended on how much money you were earning. Mm. Yeah? But, of course, what's happened is the whole push of Tory policy from the 80s onwards has been to get everybody into private housing one way or another, buying their house. And, of course, as house prices rise, that's free money for those people. And, of course, also, of course, when they sold off the council housing stock to existing tenants, I mean, some of the people in London who were living by the river, they were basically given, £1 million by the government.
I'm going to put it on you now, Martin, because you're always saying, in Germany it all works fine. No, here it doesn't, does it?
Well,
it's not working here at all.
No, it doesn't. In Germany, they've still got things like rent controls in places like Berlin. And, of course, middle-class people don't necessarily buy their houses in the way they do here. They rent quite luxury apartments, but they rent them. And, of course, this has implication in the way the economy works. So what happens, what they used to call stop-go, which is really go stop. As the economy in Britain starts to pick up, the house prices start to rise in the southeast of England, it all starts to, and then they've got to put the brakes on to stop it, to stop inflation. And by doing that, of course, you're wiping out all the industry north of the Wash.
Well, I just want to say something a little bit positive about all this, because we had suddenly a parking scheme imposed on us at the beginning of the year in our my housing scheme. Posters appeared up there and plaques on the wall saying any car that's not registered will be fined, blah blah blah. We looked at, oh, this is a bit strange, and we just made an immediate complaint about that. We got a little what's called service charge review group. It's just a handful of us, two or three of us, made a complaint about that, and they immediately came back and took the posters down, because they actually, it was all completely unlawful what they were doing. And this was just I suppose some kind of grifter basically coming along saying, look, you know, if I can find a car that's send someone down here, get a registration plate of something that's not registered, that's money for me. And so this just seems to be the way they try and do things. But so what I'm saying is, by actually sending in a written complaint that may have to come back through your letterbox, oh dear, maybe an email. I think they prefer emails, because they can always say, oh, we didn't receive that.
Or they don't open it. I find email trails better than a phone call, because it's like, who did you speak to, when did you speak to, and how are you meant to document all that. But what I do is, if I've got a complaint, I find all of places for people's emails, and they do this thing, it hasn't got places for people in it, sometimes it's called customer hub, CSC, which is customer service complaint, or there's another one which is for the managers. I just get them all and just email everyone, so they can't say they didn't get it. Yeah. So
what about you, Emma? Have you made any complaints? Because this is what you've got to do if you get any action at all.
So many, yeah. I've had to.
I mean, we used to do. You used to phone up the housing officer often; it would get sorted. And this is why we've got this 500% or 475% increase over the last 5 years. Is because the housing officers are not able to deal with things mostly anymore,
and you have to make a complaint. I don't know if you have, Em.
I mean,
or your actual to places for people. Have you actually managed to complain to them or the ombudsman or anyone?
Yes, I've complained multiple times about different things, and this latest thing with the intercoms and doors is currently being processed by the ombudsman. But places for people are still going ahead with changing my door on the 12th of June, even though I have a doctor's note saying it's making me feel really unwell. Even though all this, they're not listening. They don't care, because they know that it's a year wait to be seen.
Right, so you have still got a letterbox, have you, at the moment?
Yes, because I've been blocking them changing my door, but they...
Can you not change the locks on them, maybe? I'm just thinking about tactics, and also maybe Acorn or someone like that can come along and
help. Don't mention them to me.
Oh dear, why not? What's up?
You tried, didn't you?
I tried. Yeah. I just want to bring it to that thing you were saying about rent caps, and I know that the Labour government are saying they're bringing rent caps. I'm not very knowledgeable about all of this, but just seems that people can't afford to work and pay the rents in this country, and surely rent caps are the way forward. But what is going to happen with this in this country?
Well, I think what's interesting is that the Universal Credit, which I'm on Universal Credit even though I'm working, because otherwise I couldn't work.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is the joke.
It's, you know, but what they did is, Chakrabarty, who writes in The Guardian, did a very good article about this a few weeks ago. What they're doing is, they won't increase the rents in an area, or whatever they are.
Unaffordable.
And it used to be that they would have to pay the rent in that area as a notional part of your
is this rent
credit.
Caps for alpha benefit? It's not capping what people can charge.
No, yeah, but that's right. But I mean, but in any case, the rules used to be for benefits
that they
would have to pay what the local rate was, and it'd be different in different parts of the country. But what they've been doing now is they've been forcing down the amount that they're willing to pay. Mm. So in actual fact, the money you're getting isn't enough to pay the rent. And surprise, surprise, there's been a massive increase in homelessness in the period where this has been coming in.
And Martin, this is a terrible mess, isn't it? And it's not getting any better. We all need a roof over our heads. What can be done? Anything can be done? Do we just have to get rid of the government?
The obvious thing to do would be to... you could build more council houses. And then, because even now we have 13 years of Labour.
We had Paul Smith, who was here. Yeah. He was trying to do that. He was being blocked not only by the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, but also by the head of the housing, the officer who's in charge of housing at Bristol City Council. And so he basically just walked. He gave up. He said, I can't do that. And he's now running a housing association in the city. So if the administration is getting our votes, the Labour administration as it was previous to the Greens, based on this whole idea of building council housing, and then the guy who's put in charge of it, who's quite capable of it, says, they're stopping me doing it. And walks. This is being used to gather votes, but they're not actually interested in doing it, are they?
Well, the thing is that the system doesn't. I mean, if you build council houses, the people in them are then entitled to buy them. Yeah. Now that's stupid, really.
Very.
What's the point of building a?
Well, apparently people in our housing associations are entitled to buy them.
Yes. Well, in other words,
they don't. I've been told that we're not.
Well, we are apparently entitled legally, but they just don't let you.
Really?
That's the way it seems to work, nowadays. I mean, one of my neighbours was trying to buy their place, and she was told by the solicitor, yes, they all should do it. They just don't. They just don't let you.
Yeah, it's rent to buy. So you pay a portion of the what it would be for, like, a mortgage, and then you portion of it for your rent.
Well, you could say, I'm in private rented. Maybe I should have the right to buy my flat from the people who own it.
Mm.
But, of course, all of these things
You might have paid off the mortgage if you've been there for 20, 30 years.
Well, that's what I'm doing for the people who own it. Yeah, I'm paying for their pension.
What I'm saying is that what needs to happen, because something's got to change, the people's disposable income's going down, and the quality of housing that they're getting is going down at the same rate.
We're lining the pocket of the rich who own these houses.
That's right. It's a landlord focused system. Yeah, and think about the Duke of Westminster. He's the biggest landowner in the country.
Think about HSBC. Think about places for people. These are the people that are creaming it, aren't they?
Well, no, they're operating within a commercial environment. Yeah. Whereas previously the council, but if it was council tenancy, they're not there to, you know, they're not there to make money. They're there to provide housing.
My experience with Knightstone Housing was on the board of them. What's been going on is more and more people from private industry are being brought in to be executives senior managers.
The executive to ours is some American businessman who doesn't give a flying F about us.
That's right.
In my opinion.
So, in other words, the whole idea is to commercialise everything so that the state is not involved. And of course, you know,
at some point, you'll probably find BlackRock.
Well, that's right. Yeah, they will. I mean, that's what's happened in the US. A lot of housing has just been bought up by banks and has been rented out. But, of course, the housing crisis in the US is worse than here. People live in cars, tents. You know, you go around. You know,
isn't this being caused by all this mass migration? All these new people?
No. There's plenty of housing in Bristol. It's just in somebody's big house. You know, if you go up to Clifton, there's five bedroom houses.
There's quite a lot of empty properties that people are buying as an investment.
That's right.
And they're not necessarily even living in.
That's right. So some of the tower blocks in central London, and maybe the ones that are going up down here, there's nobody registered to vote in there because they're not locals. They are people, you know, there's Colombian drug lords and Saudi princes
buying houses in London. Anyway, if you're going to try and make a difference in your housing association, if you're lucky enough to live in social housing, you can make complaints to the organisation. You can have there's a two-stage complaint process, the way I understand it. And then if you're still ignored after two lots of complaints, which is the usual, then you can then send to the housing ombudsman and join the list of the thousands and thousands of increasing people. Is there anything we can do, Martin, to sort of bring these housing association places back into public ownership?
Well, I mean, the point about it is, once you've made an aquarium into fish soup, it's very hard to make it back into an aquarium. Yeah. So, in other words, a lot of these policies that have been pursued since the 1980s are designed to be irreversible. Yeah.
Is that because of the legally these?
No, it's
these
just
people?
It's just physically impossible. Yeah, the
well,
people
it isn't
who
really,
benefit.
Is it? I mean, if you make some sort of payment to a housing association, and then that can just transfer the ownership to, say, for example, Bristol City Council's housing department.
Well, I think what may happen at a certain point, especially if there is a housing crash and a crisis, is they'll have to do something more dramatic. And, you know, it'll take something like that for them to do it.
Can I say that a depressing thing is that if enough people made complaints to the ombudsman, people like Place for People would be formally investigated, and they could even be shut down and, you know, have the property returned to whoever, the council. But unfortunately, most of the people most of the people that live in them, they're worn down, or they might not be from this country, they might not know about doing formal complaints. There's different reasons. People are not complaining, and so getting away with a lot. I've reported them to the Information Commissioning Office for violation of our data. Yeah. One example is we come home, we find we've suddenly got a new intercom screaming out our voice note and our personal phone number onto the street. Really disturbing, particularly as a woman. And because, I mean, yes, I've formally complained. No, not anyone else I know, maybe Julius has. And they actually told things that weren't actually in line with reality to the ICO. And I was actually so worn down at that point, I couldn't be bothered to keep fighting.
It's a long process, isn't it?
If everyone had done it, they would have had a huge fine. But unfortunately, just me and a couple of others. So this is how they get away. They're serving the most vulnerable.
Also, you've got more than one housing association, so it's not one structure. If it was the council, it's one structure.
Mm.
You can go to your local councillor and say, I'm not happy with blah, and then they can...
So, Martin, what do you think is behind? I mean, this door entry system with no letterbox and the bizarre calls over to France...
Can I say something?
Yeah, cool.
One thing we haven't mentioned, another nice surprise I've had, because I've got a normal intercom person to come and look at the system to see if there's an alternative that actually works that I could put in, because the signal isn't strong enough in St. Paul's. It's a phone signal-based system. Failed for me about half the time. But I've been told, you have good signal, you live in the inner city. So that's their response. So anyway...
Not
this,
necessarily, I can tell
no,
you.
No, it's not. This guy said to me, all you needed was a £200 wired intercom. This is over £1,000 worth of kit. This is like having an old banger with a Ferrari with an old banger's engine. Like, this is designed for a tower block. It was overheating all of our fuse boxes. But the thing that none of us even realise is we are going to be charged for a SIM card to operate this thing that we don't want. So that is either going to be £12 extra a month for the houses. If there's two of you, that's an extra 50, for me, for three of us, 50 quid a year. But we haven't even been told, or it might be pay as you go. I don't know. But all these costs, there's no regulation at
This is a little bit sinister, a little bit almost fascistic,
yes.
The way that it's just being done to people. Right, we have decided you are going to have to put up with this. You are going to have to do this. What's your experience of it? Sorry, go on.
Oh, sorry, one of the things that just reminded me, when they fitted the door, I had the door propped open. We've got a double buggy for Alina and Eli. Alina leant on this electromagnetic door, just the frame, and it burnt her hand. And I said, are you all right? And she said, the door is boiling hot. And I put my hand on it, it was boiling. So I went upstairs, got an ice cube, and did a video of this ice cube melting. And they came and they fixed it in the end. But that's just unacceptable. And one of the things I wanted to say is, how in this country that is meant to be one of the richest in the world, is the housing situation so bad? And I'm just thinking of Libya, where you were given a house, you were given education, and you were given all these things.
Healthcare.
Yeah, and healthcare from a man that they said was completely evil, which was Gaddafi, who is now dead. How has he managed to do that in North Africa, in Libya? And here we're unable to do that. It's just all about money.
It's like we're
money,
still feudal, money. Going back to serfdom.
Well, it is. I mean, that is exactly it. Mm. We've inherited a very...
Landlords.
Reactionary state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
This is a feudal state which had a few... you know, tweaks on it to make it more kind of socially friendly, and then they've got rid of all
of that. A brief bit of socialism after Second World War, now it's gone.
Yeah, well, they deliberately dismantled it. The whole thing of the council housing system, and it was Macmillan who built the most council houses. He boasted about it.
This is a Tory.
He said, I'm happy to do this, and this is what we want to do.
Mm.
And, of course, the thing that from the point of view of the Thatcherites was that these people who lived in stable council housing tended to vote Labour because, you know, they're the people providing the house.
Yeah,
and, of course, also you can go on strike. Yeah.
Mm.
Because this won't make you pay the rent while you're on strike.
Mm.
But of course, what they've done is they've made everybody, it's a social engineering thing to make everybody selfish, focused on their own family, not thinking about anybody else. And they've succeeded very significantly. Yeah, they've created an infrastructure that reproduces that, and it's very difficult to change.
If my name was Angela Rayner, which it isn't, very glad to let you know, I would be saying, well, we've got this thing called the Renters' Rights Bill, which it makes it more difficult to evict people. But the problem is that there's nothing to stop them. This is private landowners. Mm. There's nothing to stop them upping the rent. If you can't pay the rent, they can still evict you.
That's right.
So this is a call for rent caps. This is where you were talking about rent caps, Mart, earlier this year, within tenancies, as the Lambert Bill returns to the Commons. It's almost like the Labour Party are taking the mickey, because they're saying we're trying to help you, but they've forgotten the most important thing, which is a landlord that wants to get rid of you, or else has decided that he wants to get more money in and he can't afford to run the place, because there's a lot of changes in the tax regime that have made it more difficult for buy-to-let landowners, that they can just up the rent and get you out that way. I mean, how can the Labour Party forget that?
What it is they're making gestures in the right direction, but they don't want to do anything more radical than that, because it's going to frighten the horses.
It sounds to me as if it's the financial markets that are really just telling them
there are things you can talk about and things you're not supposed to talk about. I mean, there was 13 years of Labour government with Tony Blair, and one of the things they could have done is said, we're going to cancel this right to buy policy. But they didn't, because it was popular with those who benefited. And therefore they didn't do it.
Well, fascinating conversation, and thanks everybody for joining us. Just want to give everybody a last word. First of all, you, Julius, what advice have you got to people who are having problems with either their private landlord or a social landlord like yours?
Do not give up. You mentioned that when you were in your property, Emma, you were really happy to be there. Me too. I was so thankful because I was in private rent, and then when I had a little dip in employment from working for places like Hewlett Packard and Motorola, I was thankful that there was this net there for me, because I'd been paying my taxes and things like that, and trying to contribute to society, as they say. And having my place then allowed me to continue and then work for the BBC eventually. But don't feel that you owe anyone. Like, this should be your right to be in a property and have a safe property. So complain, use the complaints procedures, keep writing, make sure you send emails. Don't just ring up and if you do ring up, document who you spoke to. Make sure you document who you spoke to, but an email is there and no one can deny it. Or what date did you send it? Didn't you just look through your emails? And then if you need to, escalate it, because it will go, it has to go through the process within. You have to give, like, let's say, places for people. You have to give them a chance to put it right. And if you're not happy, go to the ombudsman. So, yeah, tenacity, I guess.
Emma, what do you think? What advice have you got for people out there that may be having problems with their landlord?
Well, I can't really speak for private renting, because I'm not sure if there's...
Well, we'll leave that one to Martin.
Very much you can do.
There are
good private landlords out there, but... yeah, we've got more security and ability to complain when you're in social housing, so that's a big advantage. And the only advice I'd say is similar to Jules, is to keep going through the complaints processes and get your MP involved. And I will be going to Avon Law Centre once this goes through the Ombudsman. If I'm not happy, I'm not going to be stopping anytime soon.
Yeah, and if you want anyone to stand outside the door to try and stop them putting this stupid door on, just give me a call. So I'm only around
Thank
the corner.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think this is really crucial. Now, I mentioned Acorn. You was a little bit negative about them, didn't think they were going to be helpful.
They haven't helped me, but I mean, I haven't mentioned they want this 30-inch hallway up 4 flights of stairs. It's a domestic hallway, and I'm now expected to squeeze past strangers who want to deliver the post. It's really traumatic for me. I feel completely trapped. I don't want these codes. I don't feel safe. I want my right to enjoy the place peacefully. It's being taken away, and it's making me feel poorly. So
I mean, we could sabotage the system. That's what they used to do behind the lines back in World War II, sabotage.
Mm. My advice is be awkward.
When you know you're right and you know they're wrong. Martin, what about you then, finally, with the private landlords?
Well, I don't think there's any easy solutions. My buy-to-let landlords, they're Welsh farmers, they're okay. I do deal with them. Some people never see the landlords because you just deal with agents. I know that, you know, that what will happen when the property market goes down, which is what happened to me last time in 2008, is all the buy-to-let landlords sell up, and at that point you're evicted, and it's very difficult to get anywhere else to live. It's only through personal connection through the Labour Party that I managed to get somewhere to live in Eastern. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to do it. It's a nightmare. And I don't really know what the solution is.
Housing should be a basic right, and I don't think people should be allowed to make profit from it. I guess that makes me a communist or something. But well, I mean,
there's a conservative government built all these houses.
Yes, I know, but that's maybe conservatives that had a social conscience.
Well, that's right. And they also realised it's the way to do it.
Yes, it is, because also surely it's better for industry that the people afford to work.
That's right. It pushes up the cost of labour.
This is a major reason why China is doing so well. It's because it's so impossible and expensive to employ anybody in this country.
Yeah, because of housing.
And in the US,
it's also electricity, transport costs.
All the things that are not regulated that are basic rights, basic needs.
Margaret Thatcher.
Well, that's right.
All roads lead bad
to her. Can we do anything about it, though?
Well, I mean, you know, we have workers' policy.
We have to have a crash, do we?
Well, I think that it's something like that. It was the Second World War that led to the creation of the council houses. Before that, people really did have to struggle in private rented, and that's what they had to do. Mm. But, you know, the war itself, don't forget, the place has been bombed, loads of people have been killed. So, you know, they created the NHS and created, proper social housing.
Well, it's a shame the Labour Party just seems completely incapable of doing anything.
Well, they're trying to, don't forget, they've got to win swing voters in the marginal constituencies around London. Are all buying their houses. You know, we're still subsidising young people to buy their houses.
Well, they're swinging away from Labour, I hate to tell them. They're swinging away if they're swing voters. They're swinging towards a certain person called Nigel Farage, who we've just had some amazing poll results out this week, at the end of the week, where he started this week after the bank holiday on the Tuesday. I thought it was really rather smart of the... they do seem to have an extremely good public relations strategy at Reform UK, where they... because I was complaining last week, saying, we've just had this deal done, apparently, with the European Union, and nothing from Farage all week. So he leaves it until after the bank holiday, when Kerry Badenoch and others are all off on holiday, to launch his broadside. So let's have a listen to that, and I'll put a full version of this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. And thanks ever so much, Emma and Julius, for joining us to talk about social housing.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I know many will say, look, marriage is outdated. Most people don't bother to get married anymore. And, you know, I'm hardly standing here in front of you as a religious priest and moralising. I'm not sure my own track record is ever so good on this. And we all lead imperfect lives. But what is true, what is absolutely true, and the evidence is there to prove it, is that where people who are married stay together for the longest period of time, the children that grow up in those environments have the best chance of success in life. Doesn't mean you can't survive outside of those circumstances. Of course you can. But I do think having this transferable tax allowance, perhaps making marriage something that is just a little bit more important in terms of the family, I do believe that it is the right thing to do. And of course our biggest aspiration is that working people should not start to pay tax until they earn £20,000 a year. It's a policy that is wildly popular. It is a policy that would encourage people to get off benefits and to go back to work. We also recognise those that have worked during their lives, save for a private pension, are now penalised by the withdrawal of the winter fuel allowance. If you don't have any savings, you'll still get the winter fuel allowance. So we're punishing working people at all stages of their life, and we would reverse, absolutely reverse, what has happened and are taking away of the winter fuel allowance. Now, of course, you will all be lined up in your droves to say to me, how on earth can you afford all of this? How on earth can you afford 5 billion here or 5 billion there? Almost forgetting that the national debt is now 2.8 trillion. And that not just the last government, but this one too, are hopelessly adrift when it comes to government borrowing. We are going to make big savings. We will stand here before you in 1 year's time and show you the excessive costs that we've taken out of local government. And at a national level, if we win the next election, we will scrap net zero, something that is costing the Exchequer an extraordinary £40 billion plus pounds every year. There will be no more asylum hotels or houses of multiple occupancy. People who come here illegally across the channel or on the back of lorries will not be allowed to stay. We will scrap the DEI agenda, which is costing the taxpayer up to £7 billion a year throughout the public sector. And yes, we see considerable savings to be made amongst the quangos. So yes, I do accept that these proposals, especially the one of lifting to £20,000 the level at which people start paying tax, I accept that it's expensive, but I genuinely believe that we can pay for it because we're not ideologically tied to the same ideas upon which we believe the Conservative and Labour governments have gone so wrong over the course of the last few years. As for community, we are totally appalled as a party at the growth of two-tier Britain under two-tier Keir. I want to make it absolutely clear, Lucy Connolly should not be in prison. The sentence that was given to her was absolutely excessive, and while she should not have said what she said, understand there were millions of mothers at that moment in time after Southport feeling exactly the same way. We also find it appalling that there is now open discrimination in employment advertising against white British people. DEI must go. We are a party that believes in meritocracy. We're a party that does not accept that somehow there is something uniquely awful about the British people or about our past. We believe the opposite. We actually believe that the British people are the most open-minded and tolerant country, frankly, that you could find on earth. So we feel very strongly about that. We, of course, shake our heads at early prison releases. And this is an area that Sarah Poachin, our new MP, this is an area that and the failings in our judicial system that she is going to deal with. And we will, of course, end mass migration into Britain and be unafraid to talk about migrant crime. I was utterly demonised between 10 and 20 years ago for suggesting that opening the doors would lead to bad people coming into Britain. What I said was that from poor countries, we'd get their best people and their worst people. And I think if you look at the crime statistics in London and elsewhere, of the gangs that have been allowed to come in from Romania, Albania, or wherever else it may be, I do believe that I was absolutely right. And when it comes to country and a sense of what a nation is, of what national sovereignty is, of what the national interest is, this is where I do personally want to confront the Prime Minister head on. I think what we've seen over the course of the last 2 weeks is who Keir Starmer really is. He absolutely is the globalist. He absolutely is the person that bows down to this concept of international law in the face of courts that are either horrifically outdated or, frankly, wholly illegitimate. And yet that's what he believes in. The EU reset, which starts to align us back with EU law, not just that that exists today, but that that comes in the future, that brings the European Court of Justice, back into our lives. That is a total sellout and something that he promised he wouldn't do. There is much more to come out about defence. We haven't yet heard the full extent of the defence package. And yes, of course, you'll say to me, oh, well, Nigel, fishing is only 0.5% of our GDP. Well, of course it is. We've destroyed it over the course of the last 50 years. We traded away what was ours when we first joined the common market. And as I think the only MP with a vested commercial interest in fisheries, which I do, I can't even tell you what this surrender means. The leaders of the French fishing industry associations have said they can't believe their luck. They're being allowed to fish up to our six-mile line for a further 12 years. It means the death of nearly all of our inshore fishing industry. Because the old people retire, the young people won't come in. It is an absolutely horrific betrayal, and yet they seem to have no guilt about it, let alone the environmental damage that has happened since Brexit, where the French, Dutch and Danes have fished between the 6 and 12 in a way that is wholly unsustainable, and yet we've done absolutely nothing. When it comes to Chagos, I think this is the worst deal I've ever seen in my life. There was absolutely zero legal necessity to give away the sovereignty of the Chagos Islands. None whatsoever. An advisory judgment from a court that is not legitimate and that has too much Chinese influence in it. And we're paying to do it. And if inflation runs at an average of 3% for the next 99 years, it's £52 billion. It's almost unbelievable that he could have done it, and not to have even referred to the Chagossian people who've suffered terrible racism in Mauritius. Terrible racism. And now that this deal is done, they're now fleeing Mauritius and coming to our country, which they can do, of course, because they are British subjects. But I suppose, to Keir Starmer, racism only comes from people without university degrees. He probably doesn't think it happens between other races. The World Health Organization, of course, he signed us up to the pandemic treaty. Everything he's done in the last 2 weeks has been against our national interest. Everything he's done in the last 2 weeks will be undone by us in government, regardless of what the consequences are. He doesn't understand what national sovereignty is. He's never, ever, ever got over the Brexit result, and he's frankly doing his bit incrementally to reverse it. Now, I came back into politics on June the 3rd last year because I believe that our country has to be turned around. I came back into politics on the 3rd of June last year because I believed I had the ability to really give momentum to this political movement. And I've lived a bit. I've had some great successes in life. I've had plenty of failures in life as well. But what I bring to this now is experience. What I bring to this now is passion. What I bring to this now is a kind of courage or madness, you can take your own pick, which perhaps you only have when you've survived a few close brushes with death and even managed to go through the snake pit on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. But the qualities that I offer are hard work, passion, and yes, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not afraid of a mob. I'm not afraid of criticism. I'm not afraid of protest. I believe that reform represents a silent majority in Britain. I believe what you're witnessing is the beginning of a genuine political revolution, something quite remarkable that is happening and will continue to happen in British politics. And if that means I'm pitted against the Prime Minister and whoever the leader of the Conservative Party may be, well, so be it. I think I'm ready for that right now. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, he does then take questions. after that, and I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He's talking about, I mean, when he starts to talk about, I've been doing this for such a long time, blah, 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 and so many years, and you do think, well, he's about to announce his resignation, but he doesn't. Martin, anyway, what do you make of the Farage phenomenon? I know you don't like his role in Brexit, but, I mean, the people voted for him, so tough.
Well, I mean, he's obviously a competent politician, and he's destroyed the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party's finished. Reform are going to take their role.
He's talking about things like marriage, isn't he? No one is talking about.
Well, he's talking about marriage, and he's how many wives has he had now? Is it three or four?
But he's not talking about his personal life, is he? So, okay, so he can't talk about marriage because
he can talk about it, but because
he's talking about married tax allowance. So maybe you get a married tax allowance however many wives you have.
Yes, okay. I mean, this is Conservative politics of
don't Labour care about marriage? No.
Well, no. Labour.
Why is it Labour aren't interested in marriage then? Why is it Conservative?
Labour. You can't accuse Labour politicians of not being interested in marriage.
Why do you say it's a Conservative thing then?
No, because going on about the family in a certain kind of a way is a Conservative trope.
In saying that it think it's a good idea. Right, that's what he's saying, isn't it?
It's not.
And that it should be fostered by government.
Okay.
Marriage and family should be fostered by government. Why is that a Conservative thing? Not a Labour thing.
It's neither, really. It's not that important in terms of the big scheme of things. He covered a lot of ground there. You've chosen to fixate
on marriage.
That's
where he started, yeah.
Okay, that's where he started. The main thing that Keir Starmer has been saying about it is the sums don't add up.
Okay, would you like to pick up what he was just saying?
He's talked about the
Tories and Labour.
Yes.
And explained how people don't want to vote them for the money more. And I think most people can relate to that, can't they?
They can, but they might. But once they've voted for reform, they might not want to vote for them anymore because you've got to manage the economy.
This is exactly what Steve Hall was saying last week. He's saying you're going to get 5 years of reform and then you're going to hate them and you're going to want to get
they might not even win, but they're definitely in contention in the way that the Conservatives are not, but on the other hand they're not necessarily going to win, because I mean Nigel Farage is a bit like Marmite, it's a bit like Corbyn. Some people love him and some people hate him. Yeah. There's lots of ethnic minorities who will never vote for him, whatever he says.
And there's lots of ethnic minorities that do.
Some will, but many will not.
So,
Tony.
What would you project into the future then? Because there's a new poll out today, actually, which is looking at what a parliament, if there was a general election tomorrow, what it would look like, and what the various swings would be.
Yes, I mean a general election is 4 years away. Let's put that clear.
Would you just give us your projection then? Do you think Labour would get back in?
Well, I think no. I think what will happen is that Labour Party is losing votes to reform in some parts of the country, but they're also losing votes to the Liberal Democrats, the Greens, and other parts of the country, like here. The Labour Party is finished in Bristol, really.
So do you want to give us your rough poll? Because the poll's out. If you can guess it
they're on about 29%, aren't they? Labour's on about 20%. Lib Dem's on about 15%. But if you add the Labour vote to the Lib Dem vote, that outvotes reform. And in a proportional system, they would never form a government. They may squeak home in first past the post if the rugby ball bounces right.
Let's just have a look. They haven't got
50% of the vote.
Let's see if the poll agrees with you. So if you have a Lib Dem Labour pact, could they beat reform? What they're predicting now is that Labour, if there was a general election tomorrow, would get 160 seats. Lib Dems would get 79 seats. So that is 240 seats, which would be more than Reform, who are predicted to get 220. So we could be looking at a Lib Dem Labour pact to keep Reform out.
That's right. That's what I would predict will happen.
And do you think that? Yeah. Do you think I suppose that's actually the role of the Lib Dems, isn't it? They did it previously with the Conservatives, is to make alliances with Labour and Conservative in favour of the global financial elite.
Well, it's not just in favour of the global financial elite. It might be in favour of a social policy on housing, which the reform isn't interested in.
Also, anyway, it's interesting. The figures are quite interesting. I'll just run through them. Yeah. They're saying that reform, if there were a general election tomorrow, reform would get 220 MPs. That's up 215. So we've only got five now. But there's been a massive swing towards them amongst the voters from the local elections and from this poll as well, which has been taken since then, earlier on this week. And I'll put a link up to it all so you can see whose poll it is as well on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. So Labour, so you've got Reform at 220, Labour are next at 160, which is down 251, which is going down much faster than Reform is going up even. I suppose this is the honeymoon period is over.
They're losing votes on the left as well. That's why the Labour Party...
And the Conservatives have already lost most of theirs at the local elections and, of course, at the general election. So they're only down 16. The Conservatives are around about 105 MPs. Lib Dems, 79 MPs. They're increasing, so they reckon up 7 MPs. SNP are going up considerably. That is to 43. That's going up 34. And the Greens apparently will get an extra 2 MPs on the current polling, up to 6 MPs. So that gives you a pretty clear idea that there's been an enormous great swing, really, over to Reform, and it's carrying on. And the reason for that, it seems to me, is that Farage is winning the PR battle. I mean, he's done this amazing job in talking about, as he was about the benefit, getting rid of the two-child benefit cap.
Interesting. Let's pick that up.
And the winter fuel allowance. Now, everyone's criticism of it, and we're going to hear some in a minute, is that you can't afford to do this, Martin. Can he?
No, he can't. What will happen over the summer is that the Labour rebellion against the two-child cap, because what's happened with Farage is the same as happened with the national rally in France. They've started to move to the left on policies to try and win over former Labour voters. Now, this is the definitive end of Thatcherism. I feel like saying to Farage, so we want to renationalise the water industry. Jolly good. What did you say when Margaret Thatcher privatised it? Oh, you were all in favour of privatising it, but you've now decided to renationalise it. Now, isn't that interesting?
Well, quite a few people, I think, have changed their political views over the last 50
that's
years.
That's right, capitalism is on the way out, Tony. Well, even Farage can see it.
Yes, maybe, yeah.
And that's what the Labour Party needs to do, is say capitalism. What will happen over the summer is there's going to be a massive rebellion on the Labour benches against these benefit cuts, because Farage has opened the door to it. And then what will happen?
This is very clever politics, isn't it? Well, it's very unexpected, this. He's filled a gap, which loads... I mean,
Conservatives couldn't fill that gap because they're the ones who decided to put the two-child benefit...
They can always backtrack if it means they're going to win more votes. Do you not admire Farage's ability to get popularity and get voters?
When he says something right, I will agree with it. Of course we should abolish that two-child cap. It shouldn't have been brought in the first place. It's an outrage. It's one of the main causes of child poverty in this country. And the Labour Party...
But both Labour and Tory are behind it.
Yes, because both in hock to the City of London.
An open goal to Farage, haven't they?
Yes, the point is the Labour Party needs to pick that ball up. Yeah. And then we've got to talk, what we really need to see, I'd be really serious when Farage says, you know how we're going to fund this? All that stuff he's saying, well, we're going to get rid of local council waste. That's ridiculous. The austerity on local councils over the last 30 years has been criminal. And we're not going to be able to save any money. What we need to do is raise taxes on people like Nigel Farage. Now, if Nigel Farage is man enough to come out and say, yes, we want to do all these things and we'll have to raise taxes on people like me.
You'll vote for him.
I might be convinced to vote for him, but since he's not saying that, I won't.
Okay, fair enough. Anyway, his main target, even though, of course, he's already really beaten them in the polls, seemed to be the Conservatives in his speech. He was criticising Starmer, obviously, because he's becoming the leader of the opposition at the moment, even though he's only got five MPs, at least in the... And I was quite... By the way, absolutely horrified, really, to see the BBC not have anybody from Reform on. Question time. What are they playing at? They have the Liberal Democrats on there. They have Labour and Tory MPs, but no Reform, even though Reform is way ahead in all the polls. So the BBC are going, oh, actually, we don't really like Reform. We don't really want Reform on. Now, look, whether you agree with Farage or not, and there's much, much to disagree with him about, you should at least allow their MP onto something like Question Time. What I like about the Reform people, although I do think that Steve Hall's right, that the whole thing is a bit of a City of London con, is that they burst this uniparty bubble in a similar way to Trump has done that over in the United States. But anyway, let's have a listen to the Conservatives' sort of fight back this week, because as I said, Kerry Badenoch was away on holiday somewhere, and so she couldn't really say anything in response to Farage's bombshell press conference on Tuesday. But instead, we had a rather, I think, ham-fisted approach, having a fight back by her stalking horse, that is to say Robert Jenrick, who is many are touting to take over from Badenoch as rather a limp Conservative leader. So he had this to say this week, and what he did is he was saying that, I mean, I couldn't quite believe it, but it's true. You're about to hear it, which is he's saying that many of the country's problems come from fare dodgers on the tube and on the train. So he went on the tube and he went on the train to see what it's like trying to get the fares off people that dodge the fares.
What prompted you to sort of embark on this one-man vigilante mission against London's fare dodgers?
Well, I was fed up. I saw people dodging on the tube when I was down in London and elsewhere in the country. And I felt that ordinary people who were paying for their tube or public transport, you know, doing the right thing, were made to look silly or foolish by these people who were flagrantly breaching the rules and nothing was happening about it. And so, you know, whilst in politics you do speeches, you do urgent questions in Parliament, and that's important, that's my job, I felt sometimes you've got to get out of Westminster, listen to the public, and shame the authorities into action.
What is this a sign of? Because in the video that you've done on this, you link it to shop theft, you link it to the tool theft, you link it even to the existence of weird Turkish barbers, as you call them. Is there a deeper problem here that you're trying to highlight?
Yeah, I think this is one example of many where the fabric of society is being torn apart, is being shredded by small acts of law-breaking, sometimes actually very serious ones, whether it is graffiti, it's people on the tube playing loud music without headphones, whether it's mobile phone theft, tool theft, shoplifting. Many of these things are on the rise at the moment, not just in London, but across the country. And we've got to see the state, the authorities, stepping up and taking action. Because I subscribe to the broken windows idea that if you allow one small act of law breaking to take hold, many more people will join in, and then some of those people will go on to commit more serious offences, and the issue will just get ever, ever worse, and it leaves the rest of society feeling that the public realm isn't the safe and clean place that they want to live in, and as if the rules just aren't being applied equally. And so I wanted to highlight this, but it's one of a number of issues that I've been taking up, whether it's tool theft, for example, where tradesmen's vans are being broken into and their tools are then being sold in plain sight at car boot sales across the country, or litter, where you're seeing that fly tipping in particular increasing in many communities. We've really got to see everybody step up and take action.
What do you put that down to, Mr. Chairman? Because, of course, the rules need to be enforced, but we ultimately rely on people to do the right thing. And what you're saying is, increasingly in this country, in Britain today, people are choosing to do the wrong thing. Why?
Well, I think it's partly because the authorities are just not taking action against some of these so-called small minor crimes. And I just don't think that they are minor crimes. I think that they contribute to a broader picture, and some of them are having a very profound impact upon people's lives. You know, shoplifting, for example, even people who steal small things. You know, this is having a big impact to the point that it's costing everyone more money in rising prices, and it's making particularly independent shops' lives impossible. And tool theft, you know, breaking into a tradesman's van has a massive impact on their life, their livelihood. I've even met or read of rather tradesmen who have contemplated suicide when they've woken up and found that their tools have been stolen. You know, so these things are actually very serious, and I don't think anyone, whether it's politicians or the police or the courts, should be considering these to be minor crimes.
I think they should be taking action against them. Transport for London prosecuted nearly 20,000 people for fare dodging last year. They've increased the fines for that offence. They're spending £22 million on cracking down on it. This idea that the authorities are turning a blind eye, it doesn't match up to the facts.
Well, I don't think that's right at all, frankly, and I don't think your listeners would agree with you. If you take the example you've given of fare dodging, yes, in London, TfL's own statistics show that 1 in 25 journeys are not being paid for, that's costing other users of public transport about £130 million a year, yep, which just drives up fares. I suspect it's much higher than that. As you've seen from the massive reaction to the video I've done today, many, many people across the country have seen this in their daily lives, and it drives them mad. Just when I was at Stratford Tube Station for about an hour on Saturday morning, I saw people probably every couple of minutes doing this. So I think these problems are much more prevalent than you might imagine.
So that's the contender for your vote from the Conservative Party, Robert Jenrick, out and about with his video camera in London, explaining why the fabric of society, Martin, is being torn apart by fare dodgers.
Well, as I said while we were listening to it, Ken Livingstone's original fares fare policy was reducing fares to £1 for everybody moving across London, and ultimately the goal was to make it free. And of course, that is the real, that's what you really should do.
This is what he's opposing, isn't he, in a way? He's saying, well, we want maximum prices for public transport, and Ken Livingstone was saying, no, it should be free, it should be in public ownership.
That's right. So in other words, he's just, you know, it's the usual, you know, these bad people are doing bad things and I'm going to stop them sort of thing. You know, there's a cost of living crisis, you know.
Well, this is the sort of thing you will hear. I do use a train from time to time. I overhear things where there's confrontations with fare dodgers or people who haven't paid their fare. Women saying, well, I absolutely have no money and I absolutely need to get home from work. This is the sort of conversation that people are having. And also things like they have all sorts of special fares, and you're told by one app that you can use a train, and then they say, well, no, you're going to have to pay an extra £100. You're not allowed to use this train. They have all sorts of little games to catch you as well. But ultimately, you're right. I mean, this is a complete change around in the railways and actually with the tubes as well, since it has been privatised.
Well, it's not been privatised, has it? The Transport for London is still run by Sadiq Khan directly.
Well, I mean, look, as far as I understand it, it was just before the London bombings that we covered early in 2005 that the tube was actually privatised.
I don't think it's been privatised, Tony.
There is something called TfL, but it's not 100% completely controlled by our public. I'll look it up.
Yeah.
But the fact is that this is, you're right, it would be much easier. And all these staff can be used there for safety purposes and to help people and look after people if it was free to use.
Yes, and just think what that would do to boost the London economy, for example. Anybody coming to London knows you can travel anywhere in London for free. It's actually, you know, it's...
Think what it would do for the, as it did in the 1980s under Ken, less serious accidents on the roads.
Well,
thousands of less serious accidents.
I mean, in actual fact,
lots of people just dispensing with their car. They don't want a car
because
anymore.
Because what Ken Livingstone had, he had the business rates on the City of London. And, of course, they're fantastically profitable businesses in the City of London. A small increase in the business rate gave you a huge slush bomb to do anything you wanted. And it's perfectly feasible to tax the City of London to pay for something like completely free public transport. But that's way outside the mindset of something like Robert Jenrick. It would never cross his mind to think of doing something like that. Because it's, you know, money's money and we've got to pay it and everybody's got to pay
their
way.
Right, so TfL, you're quite right. TfL does own it. It is a public, but the operators are private.
Yes, so in other words, in other words, they brought... What should happen? It should be run as a public utility. Yeah, that's what the and of course they didn't allow competition on the roads of London. Everywhere else they brought in competition, so Stagecoach took over. They didn't dare to do that in London because it would have been totally chaotic. So they couldn't do it. You know, you're reaching the limits of free market possibilities here.
Well, this is why so many of the rail companies are now actually one by one returning back into public ownership.
Well, that's right, and they should never have been in private hands in the first place.
I mean to say the fares are going down because the people, as we've discussed on this programme several times, including with Andy Hudd, who's the vice chair of ASLEF, the train drivers union, the people that take most of the money that you're paying for your rail fare are, guess who? The Roscoes, the rolling stock companies, that is to say HSBC and the banks that actually own the rolling stock, and they lease it out. And one of the reasons you find sometimes you get on a train and it's way too short is because it's cheaper, because it's so expensive to lease these trains that sometimes the operating companies will just take half a train because it's so expensive to lease a whole train. So this, none of this makes any real sense, Martin. And of course, this is one of the reasons they're driving people into their cars the whole time.
Yes. Well, it does make sense in terms of making money for those who are behind the whole programme. I think this is where Farage is going to have to, you know, if Farage was to start talking about, you know, the reform of capitalism, you know, increasing taxes on people like him, nationalising water, electricity, this isn't conservatism of a traditional kind, is it? It's like national socialism, if that's the direction he wants to go in. But of course, I actually think he's a city boy, and at the end of the day, the people paying for his party, because of course they get loads of money in from wealthy individuals, they will never allow that to happen. They're not paying for Nigel to renationalise everything.
Well, it could be that reform get in and that we just get the same old nonsense, just as we've had in this city with the Greens, just selling out straight away. Look, the poll I gave you just now was earlier this week. Today's Daily Express has got a poll, I'll see who it's from, Electoral Calculus. They say their poll of polls has Reform UK at 30%, which is what you were saying. And they're calculating that it's enough for them to get a overall majority, actually, rather than allowing anyone to... Just let me go through the figures, Martin, and you can comment. For the first time ever. So that's just today's poll. That's just out today. I'll share the details of that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Labour is second and Conservative is now in fifth place with only 22 projected seats. The details are there at electoralcalculus.co.uk, they say. So they're predicting the general election is going to look like this. So they have a low, a predicted and high amount for the number of seats, they think. That Reform is going to be number one with 362 MPs. Next down the line is Labour with 136 MPs. Then it will be the Tories are completely out of the picture, basically, because the Lib Dems will have 62 seats, Conservatives 22, SNP 38, roughly the same as the other ones. So this is today's poll is saying that they won't have to even a pact of Tory, Labour and Liberal Democrat and SNP together won't be able to stop them.
Well, it depends how it plays out in first-past-the-post elections, yeah? Because if the Tories are still functioning, they will split the right-wing vote. I mean, the left-wing vote...
Well, it's nice for the Lib Dems. They're now apparently at third. The Tories are right now.
Yes, well, I mean, what's happening...
So Badenoch's been an absolute disaster.
They've cannibalised the left-wing of the Tory party. The sort of pro-EU business-type people who live in Esher and so on, they've just gone to the Lib Dems. So the Tory party has been, you know, has lost its votes both to the right and to the left. The same thing's happening to the Labour Party.
But let's look. I mean, Farage has played a blinder, hasn't he, to get into this position? I mean, he may not ever get to this in 4 years' time, but he's done pretty well, hasn't he, to get to that position.
Well, I mean, he's been a political operator for many years. I mean, he leveraged the proportional system of elections to the European Parliament.
He did a very good job.
He leveraged that into
pushed himself into the first past the post system by having an active campaign within the Conservative Party to get the Tories to accept leaving the EU and enforce the referendum on it as well. So he did an incredibly good job there.
He's a very
successful politician, is what I'm trying to hear. By the way, he did nearly die in a plane crash as well. But anyway, so the other thing about all this, Martin, which I think in a way is the most important point, is that he seems to have the initiative, doesn't he? Most of what Labour and Conservatives are now doing is responding to him.
Yes, and I think the Labour left, of which I would include myself, what we need to do is lay out an equally bold vision.
You mean a bit like Steve Hall saying, actually, we can pay for all this. We can pay for schools.
Yes.
We can pay for education.
That's right.
We can, sorry, no, schools are education. We can pay for health care.
What may happen?
We can pay for renationalising.
What may happen is, you know,
this is a Corbyn thing.
Well, Corbyn is still an MP, and of course he's a part of an independent group with four other MPs.
He'll join for Raj.
They've got five MPs, just as many as Reform. And of course, the other thing that
But they're not making any political capital out of it.
No, because they're not being invited onto the BBC at all.
Well,
neither are
Reform. I'm afraid. No, in question time. All right, anyway, Reform's not there.
Let's just put another thought in here. As you know, Nigel Farage is very supportive of the State of Israel. That's why he went to their Israel's independence.
Sneaky, the sneaky little party the other day, yes.
That's right. Now, if the Israelis carry on massacring Palestinians, and we go to war with Iran, which may do...
Is he more or less supportive than your leader?
He's more supportive than Starmer, but they're all in it. Yes. Farage, he talked about the Chagos Islands there. Now, what we ought to do is tell the Americans the Chagos Islands belong to the Chagossians. You take your base and take it away. We don't want your base here. We want independence from the United States of America. We want to take our base out of Cyprus because that costs millions. That's a good place. If we're going to pay...
But we are the 51st state of the USA. We can't do that.
Well, that's the problem with Nigel, isn't it? Nigel's sovereignty ends where America's sovereignty begins, and he supports the Israelis and the Americans. And when we go to war, he'll be cheering them on.
What about with the Russians?
What will happen then?
What about with the Russians?
With the Russians, he was taking a more moderate line, because that's the line
Galloway, he was one of the only politicians in the general election campaign that said, we provoked the Russians to invade.
That's right, and
he's factually correct.
He is right about that. But I think on Israel, he's completely wrong. And, of course, the next election is 4 years away. There could be a major world war before the next election in this country. People are thinking in terms of normal times. In 4 years' time, we're going to have an election and Reform will do this. No, we could be at war with Iran next week. And we're going to lose that war. We're going to lose the war.
He is right, isn't he, that you can just make this money up and you could just do these things that the government wants to do. So maybe he knows all this. Maybe he's
if you actually listen to the speech.
Clever on economics.
No, he was saying where he was going to get the money. It was by cutting expenditure in local authorities, getting...
And net zero stuff, yes. Well, these are all big corporate subsidies, aren't they? What a good idea. Let's cut them.
No.
We shouldn't be doing welfare for big corporations.
No, what we should be doing is raising taxes on people like Nigel Farage.
And printing money and giving it to the poor people.
Not just printing money. You've also got to redistribute wealth.
I agree.
Farage isn't into redistributing wealth.
You just try and get hold of that money in the tax havens. How are you going to do that, Mr. Summers?
Well, how's Mr. Farage going to do it? I mean, he's saying he's going to spend the money, but he can't
Him he's got to do it, but you don't know how.
I know how. We've got the people like Jeremy Corbyn and people in the Workers' Party, they know what to do.
You tell us. Come on.
Well, we close down the tax havens. Mm. Where there's a will, there's a way.
Well, of course we could, actually.
And of course we will have to raise taxes on people like Nigel. He will have to pay. He talks about the 1950s. In the 1950s, people like Nigel paid 95% tax.
The problem is that as soon as you start getting ready to legislate to close down the tax havens, that money's going to disappear off somewhere else, isn't it?
Yeah, well, what you really need to do is tax land and property then, because that can't go anywhere. Yeah?
Yep. What about
nationalisation of land, Tony?
Well, that'd be an interesting one.
Yeah, and then we'd have loads of money to do all sorts of things.
Would we? Where would the money come from?
From the Duke of Westminster, because we'd take all that money off him.
Well, that would be quite handy, yes. Mm. I totally agree. Yeah, so anyway, but I mean, you still haven't addressed this whole business of tax havens, but I think you're right, those tax havens should definitely be closed down. It's within the ken of British government to do that, because many of them are British government. I'm not sure King Charles would take very kindly to that, because he's the sovereign of all those little tax havens.
Yeah, well, I mean, what the current government has done is that they had various promises that they've broken in terms of things like the the pensioner payments for winter fuel and so on. And they said, we've got to break these promises because we can't raise... The other promise we made is we wouldn't raise taxes on wealthy people. Now, that's the promise they could break. Rachel Reeves could just wake up one morning and said, well, I've been breaking all these other promises. Why don't I break the promise I made to the wealthy people that I wouldn't tax them more?
Ollie Fletcher messaged me this week with an article about using... compulsory purchase orders to take farmers' farms off them, but to use for housing. So the idea is that you would only get the value of agricultural land, but that land would then be given to a housing developer, probably a bank or a big financial institution of some sort, and it would escalate the value of it by millions. So that's another way that they're kicking the farmers. I mean, it just seems to there's nobody out there that's actually got any sensible social policies. Look, I know you want to come in, Martin, but let's have a listen to your boss or your leader, Keir Starmer, and he yesterday, it took him... 48 hours or more to actually respond to Farage. And like I say, it's like a chess game. This is just him responding to Farage. He's absolutely unable, it seems, to take the fight to reform, which is why he's losing. So let's have a listen to Starmer now.
I'm proud of every aspect of our economy, everything that we do across the country. And that's why I've always said I will fight for every job. I know how important a good, well-paid job is. And I hope you've seen some of that in the trade deals that we've recently done with countries like India, the US and the EU. And only this morning, actually, you explained to me that the India deal in particular will be really important for glass and what you're doing directly and, of course, for businesses like whisky who need glass all of the time. And that comes from my absolute determination to create jobs, good jobs, and to drive down the cost of living. And put more money in your pocket, which is, I think, the thing that most people are most concerned about. That's what drives me. But you can't say that about Nigel Farage. I mean, this is the man who said that Jaguar Land Rover deserve, his word, to go bust. And he said that because he didn't like an advert that they made. This is a company at the absolute forefront of British engineering. And he says they deserve to go bust. But unlike Nigel Farage, I've been to see the workers at JLR several times over, particularly recently. And I know what those jobs mean for the workforce themselves, for their families and their communities. And I saw firsthand the anxiety on their faces. I met them just as I've met you this morning. I saw the anxieties on their faces when they thought their jobs were at risk. So when they needed support earlier this year, when we had to fight for their jobs and make a deal with the United States, I protected those jobs because I had them in my mind's eye. And politics is about who you have in your mind's eye. We protected those jobs. Would Nigel Farage have done the same? Absolutely not. And that's the question you have to ask about Nigel Farage. Can you trust him? Can you trust him with your future? Can you trust him with your jobs? Can you trust him with your mortgages, your pensions, your bills? And he gave the answer on Tuesday. A resounding no. He set out economic plans that contain billions upon billions of completely unfunded spending. Precisely the sort of irresponsible splurge that sent your mortgage costs, your bills and the cost of living through the roof. It's Liz Truss all over again. Now, in opposition, we said that she would crash the economy and leave you to pick up the bill. And we were right. And we were elected to fix that mess. Now in government, we're once again fighting the same fantasy, this time from Farage. The same bet, in the same casino, that you can spend tens of billions of pounds on tax cuts without a proper way of paying for it. Using your family finances, your mortgages, your bills, as the gambling chip on his mad experiment. And I can see that in keeping with my point, apparently he's in Las Vegas today at a casino. And it's not a surprise because he said that the Liz Truss budget, in his view, was the best since 1986. That shows his judgment. It shows what he'd do. And the result would be exactly the same. Now, I'm not prepared to let that happen. Labour's plan for change has stabilised the economy. Growth in our economy is at the fastest rate in the G7 this year. 4 cuts in interest rates. That means mortgages coming down. And a pay boost for 3.5 million low-paid workers. And unlike Nigel Farage, I know what it's like growing up in a cost of living crisis. I know what it's like when your family can't pay the bills, when you fear the postman and the bills that may be brought. And I know how much work we have to do. But there is not and never will be a magic wand that can wave away the need to manage the public finances properly. That is the foundation upon which everything rests, always. Now, we were elected to change the country. But we were also elected to never put working people through a crisis like Liz Truss ever again. And so that is what we're doing. Scunthorpe Steel, that was rescued. JLR workers protected. Wages rising. Mortgages coming down. NHS waiting list cut. 3 million extra appointments this year. The living wage raised. Water company bosses fined. You saw that earlier this week. Immigration falling. Breakfast clubs in every school. An investment in infrastructure right across the country. The biggest levelling up of workers' rights in a generation. And a massive cash injection in our public services without making working people pay. Nigel Farage stands for none of this. He literally voted against it. Against sick pay for working people. Against fire and rehire. Against cutting fuel duty. And now he wants to blow up the economy all over again. But we won't let him. We will deliver our plan for change. And we will do so precisely because we protect our economy. That is the path to change. And that is what Labour will deliver. Thank you all very much indeed. Thank you.
Well, he's picking up on the obvious flaw in Farage's strategy, which is he can't cost it through. And of course, he did indeed say that Liz Truss's budget was the best budget ever, because he believes that tax cuts are good in themselves, and therefore that the economy, if they cut taxes on people like him, the economy will boom, and we'll be able to pay all this money out to all these causes.
It wasn't just that the City of London decided to kick Liz Truss.
No.
It was just that she didn't know what she was doing.
No, she didn't know. No, because the point is, if you haven't put together a budget plan which the markets will accept, then they won't accept it.
Okay, who's in charge? Is it your Prime Minister? You've elected all the markets.
The markets, Tony. It's a capitalist society. Until we change capitalism, we could have a revolution and get rid of capitalism. Yeah? But until we have, the markets are going to... The world market is a constraint on everybody.
Farage can't do any of the things that he says he wants to do. Only Starmer can do that.
No, what Starmer's saying, I'm Mr. Sensible. You know, I'm the sensible uncle. Farage
he's considered
isn't.
Sensible by the financial elite, isn't he?
Yeah, well, Farage won't be considered sensible by the financial elite. So if he comes to power and tries to do what Liz Truss did, he will get into exactly the same problem.
He's going on about Starmer going on about workers' rights, but actually, what about workers not being able to pay the bills, not being able to pay a train fare to go home from work?
Yeah, that's a real problem.
He doesn't actually care about workers' rights, does he?
No, he does, but he's constrained by the realities of the situation. We should stop trying to make war with Russia. That would save us an awful lot of money. We do not need to rearm anything. We need to get rid of our foreign bases. You know, Farage goes on about all this foreign involvement. We need to get out. The Chagos Islands should have their islands back. The Americans should be told to go home. They should take their bases home as well. Yeah? real sovereignty.
The trouble with Starmer is people don't believe him. He started off that little clip there saying that he was proud of every aspect of our economy.
No, what he's saying there is, I'm the sensible... I'm not saying I agree with it, I'm just paraphrasing what he's saying. He's saying, I'm the sensible guy, and I know what the constraints are. We're going to do our best within these constraints. Farage has got the luxury of saying he's going to do all this stuff, but he hasn't actually costed it out, and he doesn't know how to cost it out. There is a way to cost it out by raising taxes on people like Farage, but he's not going to say that.
What you're suggesting is that Farage could get in the, I mean, obviously, Starmer's got his 4 years to prove that he means what he says about sorting out the economy and workers' rights and the cost of living and all this sort of thing. But you're saying if Farage does get in and try and do all this, the markets and the city will just stop him.
Well, if the point is he's got to win first. There's 4 years to go. Yeah, Keir Starmer's got plenty of time to turn the economy around, unless there's a massive capitalist crisis, which is what I predict is going to happen. I don't suppose Farage has got any answer to that either. If Wall Street collapses and the City of London collapses, then all bets are off.
Well, at least he's prepared, like Trump, to take a realistic view of Russia, isn't he?
Well, I think that both Trump and Farage are not regarded by the Russians as serious. They talk to them, and they're willing to listen to them, but they're not regarded as serious at all.
Well, because, I mean, what seems to have happened, if we want to get into that, is that the Europeans have just said, well, it's okay, we don't need you, America, we're going to carry on fighting the Russians on our own.
Well, except that's just fantasy. And, of course, what Trump has done...
They do seem to be...
What Trump has done... I mean, what did you see what happened last week? Is that the Ukrainians tried to assassinate Putin and tried to knock his helicopter out.
Let's talk about that, because that was a fascinating episode. It was last Tuesday.
And Trump didn't even know they'd done it.
It was last Tuesday, and it was actually only reported a week later in our press. Something like 1,500 drones were sent to kill Putin in a helicopter in the Kursk region. What Scott Ritter and others had... it was his helicopter that was flying in Kursk.
Yes.
And what Scott Ritter and others have pointed out, Martin, and you'd be really interested to get your take on this, is what they did was impossible without the US and British or Israeli, possibly, satellite intelligence about where Putin was, because they monitor all sorts of electronic movements and stuff using their satellites and other means. And the Ukrainians simply don't have that capability. So somebody here in the NATO countries and Israel made sure that the Ukrainians got onto the target. Now, reading the Russia Today articles, I'll put a link to that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later, what they're saying is they shot down something like 1,300 drones, which were trying to kill Putin. Now, we didn't really hear much about this in the press here, but this is a massively important... I mean, it's an important news story, isn't it, if Putin's life is being threatened by the West. Now, what then happened, of course, middle of last week, is there was a big attack on Ukraine, almost certainly a response to the Ukrainians' attempt to assassinate Putin. But then that is introduced to us in the press as, oh, this has just come out of the blue. What are the Russians doing? They're completely insane. Actually, it's a perfectly rational response. Imagine what the British response would be if, say, for example, there was a major unsuccessful attempt to kill the king here.
Or Starmer. Or Zelensky. What's interesting about this is that Trump didn't know that it had happened. It must have been his people that gave the Ukrainians
ISR. Maybe it's others, maybe it's Brits, maybe it's Germans. Who knows, Martin? Yeah, in NATO, it's not easy to figure out who it is. Intelligence is used.
But what happened when Trump was asked about it? Trump tweeted, or whatever it is, on the social, is Truth Social, saying that Putin's gone mad. Why is he killing all these people in Ukraine? It's totally unprovoked, blah, blah, blah. And then one of the reporters said to him, but you do realise that somebody tried to assassinate Putin. He said, I didn't know about that. Now, somebody inside the NATO structure orchestrated an attempt to assassinate Putin, and the commander-in-chief of the NATO structure, Donald Trump, didn't even know about it. Now,
he's not the commander-in-chief of NATO by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, he's a commander-in-chief.
It will be, what's his name, Rutte. Used to be Stoltenberg and Rutte.
Yes,
and the Bilderberger countries. Yes, they're the people
if you are the Russians, you are aware that Trump is just a front man.
Well,
really.
No, he's way down the food chain he's when way it comes down the to food. These military
so
operations.
So, in other words, they're talking to him because that's what people expect them to do, but they don't expect anything to come from any of this. They are going to fight to win now, and that's all that's going to happen.
I notice that they've decided they're going to take over even more of the oblasts of Ukraine if they don't come to an agreement, which seems to me obvious. That's that the Ukrainians are puppets of the NATO countries, and it's a proxy war that's being fought there now.
Yeah.
Do you think of the NATO countries is the principal in carrying on driving this war that Trump wanted to stop? Because it's clearly not the Americans.
Well, some elements within the American state do want to carry on.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, which is the principal nation?
Britain.
Why do you say that?
Because we are that the Russians regard us as the main problem. Yeah, they regard the British as particularly hostile to them. And of course, if British now, of course, the Mertz is talking about.
Is there any evidence that the British are any worse than, say, the French?
Well, the British and the French are regarded in pretty much the same light by the American by the Russians. But the British in particular come in for a lot, you know, it's been the British military, for example, who orchestrated the Kursk incursion. Yeah, that was all British generals who organised all of that. And the Russians are well aware of that. And of course, at some point, you see what Mertz is saying, they're going to allow Taurus missiles to be fired into Russia, which will hit Moscow or whatever. And of course, in the commentariats in Russia are saying, well, if you do that, we are going to hit you in Berlin. Yeah. And of course, it's quite possible that the Russians may decide to pick on a particular country in the West, which they particularly don't like, to make an example of them. And that could be us, or it might be the Germans, if the Germans are foolish enough to allow these Taurus missiles, because it needs German personnel to fire them. And the talk is that they need to hit the factory where they're made in Munich.
So this is why they've replaced the German chancellors, because the last one wasn't up for it. This one is.
Well,
war with Russia, Schultz, I'm talking about.
Schultz is part of the coalition in which Merz is the chancellor.
But he's no longer in charge,
no,
is he?
No, but he's also the SPD are opposed to what Merz is doing. And, of course, he's been flip-flopping around because it becomes, you know, it's pretty insane, frankly. It's not going to make any difference from a military point of view anyway. The Ukrainians have lost. That's all there is to it, really. And, of course, what should be happening is a Britain led by somebody like Robin Cook would have never gone to war over this in the first place.
Can you say something about this whole decapitation policy? The attempt to assassinate Putin is really... I mean, it's very different to the way the Russians fight, isn't it? They're not trying to assassinate. There haven't been, as far as we know, assassination attempts on the leadership here in the West. But there is an absolute obsession by the Ukrainians, the Brits and NATO in assassinating Russian generals and even now the Russian president.
Well, if you think about the Israeli hits on Hezbollah, the attempts to decapitate Nasrallah in Yemen, this is the tactics of the weak. You can't win the actual battle, so you think there's a shortcut if we can just kill the chiefs. Now, of course, if Putin were to die in a helicopter, you know, shot down in a helicopter, what would happen is that the system would kick in Russia and Medvedev or somebody would take over and the war would go on. So it wouldn't.
Interesting, isn't it? The motive in killing Putin is to actually up the ante and escalate the war.
Well, that's the danger of where we are.
It's not a danger. This seems to be the tactic.
Yes.
The idea of, and of course, this is the Ukrainians supposedly behind this. But what do you expect? I mean, they would want to, in a similar way to the Israelis, killing loads of people in the Middle East. The idea is to provoke an attack which would bring the Americans in behind them. So this is the concept in Ukraine as well, is by killing Putin, this would bring in the NATO powers in behind Zelensky. So this is why he's doing this.
That's right. But the thing is that NATO, even if it decided it wanted to fight with Russia, wouldn't be able to. The Russians are already, their tail is up. They've got a whole other army which they've been forming inside Russia, which hasn't been committed yet. And if there is a war between NATO and Russia, Russia will win because NATO simply hasn't got the troops. They just haven't got them. And if you try to have conscription in the US and send them over, it would take months, possibly years to do that. And by that stage, the war would be over. In any case, they would sink the troop ships. They've got submarines. You put them on the troop ships, they'll sink
them.
Now
Trump has been informed about the attempt to assassinate Putin. He's slightly changed his tune, although the press haven't really reported it. Most recently this week, he's saying, actually, he's delaying any new Russia sanctions to keep the Ukraine talks alive again.
Yes, I think what's happening here is the Russians are playing, you know, they've agreed they're going to meet with the Ukrainians in Istanbul.
Trying to keep this peace conference going is not a nightmare.
Well,
it?
I mean, they're
obviously Zelensky is trying to sabotage it as everything, right. Every way he can.
That's right.
To get more Ukrainians killed.
Well, that's right. I mean, when you've reached the point where you can't possibly win, it's totally irresponsible to carry on fighting. But there you are.
So what's his motivation in all of this then?
Personal survival and greed.
Well, he's less likely to survive if the war carries on, surely.
No, because if the war ends, it's quite possible that he will, you know, if he makes peace, the Azov battalion and people like that have said they'll kill him. They've already said that. Did you see there was a foray to Yanukovych, who was in Madrid, assassinated? Yeah, so he's a pro-Russian Ukrainian politician.
This is the Yanukovych was the president who was deposed in the 2014 coup. So he was a pro-Russian president.
Yes, that's right.
Who was elected.
Yes.
But then he was kicked out.
Well, it was
and taken over by Poroshenko, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So this guy was killed in Madrid?
Yeah.
Why?
So, because the Ukrainians are terrorists. They don't like the guy. And you see they've had this 1,000 swap, which they agreed. 1,000, yeah. Because the Russians are holding far more Ukrainian prisoners than the Ukrainians are. And so what the Ukrainians have done to make up their 1,000 that are going to be released, they've released political prisoners. Instead of prisoners of war.
This is people like journalists,
yes,
that they've been arresting,
yes,
and opposition politicians.
That's
in
right. Because they haven't got enough soldiers to swap.
Oh, anyway.
Medvedchuk, who was another politician.
It worries me, Martin, that the British, you're saying the British are at the heart of this conflict.
Yeah.
Why? What is motivating Britain, if it's British establishment, to carry on this horrific war, which could, you know, at some point spark off into a nuclear conflict? What is the motivation?
Well, I mean, the MI6 are behind all of this. They've always had a hostile attitude towards Russia. And, of course, they've been orchestrating all these kind of theatre stuff like Skripal and all the rest of it.
Why?
Because...
What do they hate so much about
ultimately,
Russia?
What they want is the raw materials in Siberia to be opened up to Western multinational exploitation, which is exactly what was happening under Yeltsin. And, of course, no...
Sour grapes,
Russian,
is it?
Well, it's not just sour grapes.
Over the Russians taking back control of their own country.
Yes, but international capitalism, which is, as we know, a great big bubble, the only way for that bubble not to burst is if they can actually basically loot Russia. Because Russia has got everything. So, you know, if they were able to get a pro-capitalist regime in Russia, working with Western Western multinationals, they could hope to reboot the system, but they can't because the Russians ain't going to let them.
Okay, so another little bit of news, which, I mean, I have my own answer to that question about Russia, and I would suggest it's much more to do with pinning the Russians down in a war, which it makes it impossible for them to intervene in the Middle East. We've just seen, for example, in Syria this week, the Americans have now reopened the ambassador's residence in Syria. So everything is kind of turning to normal, even though Al-Qaeda are now running Syria. And this is all working out rather nicely for the greater Israel. So
yes.
Isn't that maybe why the British are so gung-ho for the Russians is because the Russians are the only power in the world willing to actually intervene, as they may have done, for example, in Syria, to stop the expansion of Israel and the United States and Britain there.
That's right. So it's global. It's a global game of risk, isn't it?
So if they can keep this conflict in Ukraine on the boil all the time, the Russians are thinking, well, we don't want to annoy them too much in the Middle East because they might start...
Long-range missiles
into Moscow.
It's a question of priorities. Mm. I think the Russians...
You're turning the screws on them,
yeah.
You know, as they're saying, look, you don't want to get involved in the Middle East, do you? Because something nasty might happen to Putin, or Moscow might get bombed, might get nuked.
Did you see the stupid threats that Trump was making? That, you know, if I change my mind, I could make Russia, you know, we could do this, that and the other to Russia. The truth of the matter is, they can't. Alistair Crook, who used to be a British diplomat, I think he was in MI6, has been in St. Petersburg last week, and he's saying the mood in Russia is becoming absolutely militant. They are absolutely prepared. You know, even moderate liberal-type people are getting absolutely fed up with the West's attitude, and they're absolutely prepared to fight to the finish now.
Well, I know you go on about Farage and whatever, but the EU is not really on the right side of history on this, is it? Because they're committing £170 billion. I'm not sure how many years that is. Maybe we're about to hear it from, I think this is an Al Jazeera report, that there's a massive, massive new defence spending initiative by the unelected, Ursula von der Leyen, who's the president of Europe. And so let's have a listen to that Al Jazeera report now about this massive military expansion by Brussels. And of course, Brussels is where NATO live.
FN Herstal is one of the world's leading manufacturers of small arms and machine guns. These two weapons, the Minimi and Evolis, are widely used by NATO.
There is clearly a higher demand from European countries than a couple of years ago, there's no doubt about that. When we compare the current situation with, say, 10 years ago, our production for European countries was really a minority of our products. Today, it's I would say around 80% of our production goes to European countries.
The company has just signed a 20-year contract to provide the Belgian army with small arms and ammunition. Belgium will also be investing billions of dollars over the next years to upgrade its air defense capabilities, purchasing more missile systems and ramping up security at seaports and other key installations. General Xavier Dinez says Europe's military commanders are facing incredibly challenging times.
You need to spend smarter and spend more. It's not an or debate, it's an and. We have to do both at the same time. And there are many initiatives now being taken at European level to address the fragmentation of the defense industry, which is a major weakness of Europe for the time being.
But Belgium is struggling with a rising trade deficit. And despite repeated calls from the EU Central Bank for the country to balance its books, the deficit keeps growing.
After many decades of decreasing defense expenditures have now started to increase again, sometimes quite rapidly so. There are some nuances. Some countries are changing gears very quickly, others a bit more slowly.
Back at state-owned FN Herstal, these are busy times and revenues are increasing, with the company now investing in high-end technology designed to track and shoot down drones.
Arms makers in Europe see the potential for expanding now. This one has to churn out more weapons to meet growing demand. But to fill the continent's defense gap, the industry must invest in more production capacity, a move companies won't take unless they can secure firm long-term contracts. But that isn't going to be easy with budget constraints across Europe. Hashim Ahbara, Al Jazeera, Herstal, Liège province.
Yeah, well, that's indeed was Al Jazeera, Martin, there, talking about this massive, massive amount of money about to be spent, $170 billion on a joint defence fund. And, of course, the Brits at the agreement last week are hoping to take a nice share of that.
Yeah, I mean, the money's being spent to keep the arms industry going, but it doesn't really have a military purpose. Because it's so fragmented, as they say, most of this money will actually probably go to the United States, because that's where the kit is all
made.
It's
interesting, isn't it? Well, this is all thought of as growth.
Yes.
Back in the day, military spending was a negative.
No.
Yes, it has been. In certain, it's not necessarily, I don't know if it's GNP or GDP. We're going back a bit now. But why is military spending just included in all of the normal economy? Because it's not. It's basically, what military spending is if you want to put it in your balance sheet somewhere, it's a figure which is quantifying how much your economy has failed. If your economy has failed, then you start to put your money into building weapons.
Well, there's something that used to be called military Keynesianism, which is what the US was based on for many years, which is you spend money into the economy via the arms industry. Because, of course, the arms industry then creates, you've got a massive military force, which you can then use to extract profit and surplus value from other countries. It's a massive system of exploitation. The thing about GNP or any measures like that, any money spent on anything is counted as GNP. So, you know, people buy tobacco. Tobacco causes illness. You spend money on people in hospital. All of that adds to GNP. So both bad things and good things are just added in. So it's just a very, very, you know, it's just anything that you've spent any money on gets included in it. And, of course, it's not what you really need to think about was what is the components of GNP. And, of course, there's other human development indexes which are about, you know, what's the real wealth and health of the population. So you're looking at things like infant mortality, life expectancy and things like that.
The other thing the Brits have been doing this week is the Ministry of Defence has launched a brand new cyber warfare command. So maybe that's to take out people's electricity grids and things like that. A billion is going to cost us a billion.
Yeah, I mean, the point is, even if we decided to fight the Russians, which they seem to be doing, it's not even a practicality. We haven't got the capability to take on the Russians. We shouldn't even try. What we really need to do is actually talk to them about having a European security structure where we can actually reduce military spending all round and get on with doing more useful stuff.
Yeah, but we need to
have
this war, in case you hadn't noticed. British military are to launch a 1 billion cyber and AI army. Ah, this money's all going to people like Musk and his mates and Sam Altman and their friends and Google. The Bilderbergers, funnily, that isn't it, to strike back at Putin's hackers. So this is the new offensive cyber unit. So, yeah, if your computer doesn't work, you can go and phone these guys up and say, why are you hacking me? The plans at MOD Corsham, just around the road down the road from here, UK's military cyber HQ, Mr. Healy said that the unit will form a central part of the government's strategic defence review, due to be published on Monday. So that's Monday next week. But so it's Corsham. Now, that used to be the regional seat of government. It's a massive underground base, which we went down, because you can do a bit of caving if you want around the Bath stone mines down there. And I always remember walking about a mile and a half through these caves and coming eventually to a steel door where you could hear a generator on the other side of it buzzing away. And we banged on the door, and, of course, there was nobody replied. But this is Corsham. This was a regional seat of government here. They've now repurposed this, and I was told by people who'd worked on that project that it was the Americans that were running it. So I wonder, is this a British cyber command, Martin, or an American cyber command?
Well, a lot of this money that the EU were talking about, it's not clear where the money's going to come from, by the way. They've had to completely change the German constitution to allow them to go into debt in order to pay out this money. But a lot of NATO standard kit isn't produced in Europe. It's produced by the Americans. So what's actually happening, as Michael Hudson has pointed out, is that the US is basically destroying Europe. They're not destroying Russia. Russia's fine.
Well, it's all very high tech.
It's us that's going to go
down
the
drain. It's all very high tech. This even more high tech than a front door up the road from here entry system. It says the new digital targeting web, known informally as the Kill Web, will allow military platforms to identify, track, and neutralise threats in real time, whether by warplanes, drones, or any kind of cyber operation. So it could be anything. The idea is that they want to switch it off, turn it off, make it blow up, or something like that from Corsham, which sounds to me as if all will happen is you'll get a whole load of nukes on the top of Corsham, blowing it to kingdom come, however high down it is, or however far down it is, or maybe bunker busters with depleted uranium shells.
Oreshniks.
Yeah, or Oreshniks. Well, they will maybe do the surface, but you'll need a bunker buster to get down.
No, because Oreshniks are bunker busters.
Oh, are they?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know much more than I do. Anyway, we'll be back in a minute. We're going to have a break now, and we'll be back in a minute to have a little look at Gaza. Then we've got a few longer interviews to do with the general state of affairs. When I say that, what I mean is the great transformation, which is what is going to replace the old banking system that Martin keeps saying is going to crash. What is being prepared for us right now to replace it all?
grew up strong. We were wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face, I've changed my name. But no one wants you when you lose. Thought that I could be a fainting. Thought that we'd be last to go. It is so strange the way things turn. Drove the night toward my home, the place that I was born, on the lakeside. As daylight broke, I saw the earth. The trees had burned down to ground.
days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Dust off the sun and moon and sing a song of cheer. Just fill your basket full of sandwiches and wieners. Then lock the house up, now you're set. And on the beach you'll see the girls in their bikinis, as cute as ever, but they never get them wet. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer, those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. You'll wish that summer could always be here. Don't have to tell a girl and fella about a drive-in or some romantic movie scene. Why, from the moment that those lovers start arriving, you'll see more kissing in the cars than on the screen. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer, those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. You'll wish that summer could always be here. You'll wish that summer could always be here. You'll wish that summer could always be here.
You can find. If a daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If a daddy's poor, just do what you feel. Speed along the lane, you go down or return to 25. When the sun goes down, you can make it good and lay by. When I grab people, when I daddy, when I mean, we love everybody, but we do as we please. When the weather's fine, we go fishing or go sailing in the sea. Philosophy. Sing along with us, dee 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 dee, da 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 da, yeah we're happy, happy. Da da da, dee da da dee da 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 da, da 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 da,
right on,
da 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 da. Settle down. If she's rich, if she's nice, bring your friends and we'll all go into town. You can find. If a daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If a daddy's poor, just do what you feel. Speed along the lane, down or a turn of 25. When the sun goes down, you can make it good and live by. When I thank people, when I daddy, when I mean, we love everybody, but we do as we please. When the weather's fine, we go fishing or go sailing in the sea. We're always happy, the last we're living, yeah, that's our philosophy. Sing along with us, dee 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 dee.
So that's from 1970, Mungo Jerry. Any one of my ilk will recognise that one. Some nice fun summery songs, as well as the Crazy Lazy Hazy Days of Summer before that, from I'm not sure who wrote that or which performance it is, who the artist is or what the date on that one, sorry. But rather nice summery tunes. And then before that, we had Peter Gabriel. We don't hear very much of Peter Gabriel at all. I'm one of those people who's, I mean, a sort of Genesis fan, really. But something about Phil Collins, I find a bit of a creepy, annoying guy, you know. He's sort of successful, but Gabriel was brilliant, and he has none of Peter Gabriel's subtlety, turn of phrase, humour, metaphor that he uses all the time. So it's a bit of a pity. I get the idea that Collins kind of elbowed him out, you know, from Genesis, whenever it was in the 1970s, sometime. So I prefer the solo stuff from Peter Gabriel a lot, and it's nice to hear him there with Kate Bush, isn't it? That tune you hardly ever hear nowadays, a wonderful one. And right at the very beginning, it's He Who Would Valiant Be, the choir of Salisbury Cathedral. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to go, I think, straight to Gaza, Martin. It always seems to be the main sort of zing point here. There was a talk yesterday of a ceasefire and I found it really strange the way the media presents this. It angers me. Is they say, oh, the Israelis have agreed to a US proposed ceasefire. But what does that really mean, and what is in this ceasefire?
Well, I think the latest I saw is that the Hamas people have said that it's not satisfactory to them, and that, you know, they're not going to sign up for it. So there you are.
So why not?
Because
Hamas just being belligerent.
No, well, don't forget, there was a ceasefire agreement which the Israelis broke, which meant that they had to withdraw from the Gaza, and they had to allow aid in, and then hostages would be released. But they didn't want to do that, and they just ripped it all up. You can't just have a ceasefire where you say, we want a ceasefire with you surrendering. That's not a ceasefire. That's a surrender. And of course,
there's a 60-day initial truce that the Americans and the Israelis have agreed to without even speaking to Hamas. I mean, it just sounds to me as if there's something unhinged about the way that the London media deals with this. It's almost as if it's the Americans and the Israelis that are arranging this ceasefire, and it's just Hamas are being annoying.
Well, that's exactly why they've done it like that, to put Hamas on the spot and say, why aren't you signing up to our ceasefire? And so, because you haven't discussed it with us, and it's not satisfactory to us.
An exchange of hostages, including 10 living Israelis held in Gaza. But those living Israelis aren't actually hostages, really, are they? They are prisoners of war.
Yeah, they're mostly military.
It would also require the immediate delivery of humanitarian aid, which actually is a war crime, not delivering the humanitarian aid. So why is that part? Why would that be part of a ceasefire deal, that we will stop committing war crimes if you agree to this deal?
Well, the point is that it's performative, isn't it? It's to try and make Hamas look as if they're being the awkward ones, etc. And, of course, it isn't them being the awkward ones. It's the Israelis being the awkward ones. A ceasefire deal negotiated with Hamas means that you've got to recognise Hamas. Now, that's not the British government's position. Hamas is an illegal terrorist organisation. So we can't, you know, how can you negotiate with an illegal terrorist organisation any ceasefire? But, of course, militarily, they're undefeated. They estimate they've got 40,000 fighters in those tunnels. They might be running out of food, but I imagine they've got quite a lot of tin stuff down there. And, you know, this war isn't over.
So the only card the Hamas seem to have for the Palestinians as a whole is these hostages. They're saying, no, they're going to have to go if you want a ceasefire.
Well, what they've agreed is that they'll let some go and keep some back, yeah? once they've released the last hostage, they've got no leverage at all, have they?
They will not leave Gaza until all the hostages are in our hands. And they're calling them hostages. Actually, they're POWs. But is that could you trust the Israelis that they will leave the Gaza Strip? And even if they do leave the Gaza Strip, will they carry on bombing it?
Well, there's no deal to be done with them, really. This is the problem, isn't it? And what's probably going to happen is the war will go on and a lot of people are going to carry on dying, unless, of course, the Iranians come in because of what's happening with the Iranian deal with, you know, the on-off deal that's being discussed between Trump and the Iranians.
So he says, I have some very good feelings. This is Witkoff, the American envoy. Very good feelings about getting to a temporary ceasefire and a long-term peaceful resolution. Well, a temporary ceasefire in a way is no good, is it? You see, if it's a temporary ceasefire, then why would you start giving up hostages? Because they're only going to start bombing you and killing you again.
Well, ultimately, Hamas have got the right to say, well, we're not going to sign up for this because it just doesn't make me so, you know, why would we sign up for this?
So far they haven't signed up for it. It's almost like it was a damp squib before it was even
announced. That's right. The point is that they want to carry on with the genocide, but they want Hamas to be seen somehow to be, you know,
This is all media spin then, really.
That's right, and of course it's actually part of the
relying on the London press to be able to get away with war crimes.
It's not just the London press; it's the Western media in general.
True.
Yeah,
yeah.
They've framed
it. Give us journalists some transmitters. Give us journalists some printing presses. Let us get on with telling you what's going on, because what's going on right now is just complete and utter. It's disgusting to watch, to see these so many people. You know, what about the possibility? Because what's going on over there? Let's just go to this now, this next report, which is just about. This is from ITV News, John Irvine again. Is this mass starvation that's going on? They're saying, oh, we're going to let a few trucks in, and then those trucks go along, and then someone stands in front of them, and they're not allowed in after all. And they're trying to get this US organisation in order to distribute the aid. Of course, that's never going to work. And we've seen the latest, Martin, haven't we? The latest is various places where they are distributing food have been stormed by the hungry Palestinians.
Who end up being shot dead. And, of course, previously, when people are queuing up to get flour, they've been killing them.
This reminds me a little bit, you know, of the Irish famine, which wasn't really a famine, where the Irish were attacking the British or the English soldiers who were guarding the shipments of food that were being taken out of Ireland as they were starving. This is just appalling, isn't it?
It's worse than that, because it's more... I mean, the Irish famine was basically the British government not caring what happened to the Irish.
Well, they wanted to starve them, so they would get on ships and go to America. Well, yeah, and that was the mass migration programme of the 1880s.
Yeah, but I mean, what's happening...
70s.
Yes, but what's happening in Gaza is they're deliberately trying to kill them, you know. I mean, people starved in Ireland during the famine, but they weren't being shot down at the same time, unless they were trying to riot, whereas in actual fact they're being bombed and starved. You know, this is absolute determination to kill everybody there. It's, you know, it's not just a sin of omission, well, we're not going to do anything to help you. It's, we're actually, you know, we're trying to kill all these people off, and people like Smotrich are saying, you know, we want all their children dead. We don't want to have, you know, they're all little terrorists, and we've got to kill them all.
So I wonder if they will or not. Anyway, let's have a listen now to this report on the the report is entitled "We're Ready to Die for Food."
How much harder can it be for hungry Palestinians to get what little food aid there is being brought into southern Gaza? They've been told to walk several miles through the hot sun to a new distribution centre in the southern city of Rafah, set up by Israel, supervised by American security guards. Today, as our Palestinian journalist colleague Mohammed Abu Safia walked with them, the desperate and underfed came under fire. Day two of the new aid operation was chaotic, just as it was yesterday. Once again, many turned back for the long walk home, empty-handed and hungry.
We just want to eat. Peace be with you, says this boy before heading hopefully down Gaza's coast road. For even the youngest, it's a mouth-watering dash that they think will end with a meal. They are southbound, following Israeli and American advice. At the start of the week, US mercenaries with IDF backing launched a new aid initiative by opening a food distribution site close to the Egyptian border. It's the place they're trying to reach. We need food. We have nothing, no rice, nothing at all. We are ready to die for food. We are poor people just desperate to eat. Hamas brought us nothing but disaster. Obviously, this was no casual stroll in the spring sunshine. As they too cursed Hamas, these men thought they heard gunfire. These shocking events witnessed by ITV News' cameraman in Gaza make a mockery of last night's mission statement by the Israeli Prime Minister, who said the goal is to create a sterile zone in the south where the entire population can move for its own protection. As bullets whiz by, cover rather than food becomes their priority. As they see the new aid distribution system failing to deliver, some Gazans took matters into their own hands this afternoon, storming a UN warehouse to grab bags of flour. This ended up being a deadly stampede, with one nearby hospital reporting 7 fatalities. Those who lost their lives were either trampled on or suffocated under the heavy sacks. As the world squabbles over how best to deliver aid, Gazans are dying to eat. 2 stampedes in 2 days, one at this UN warehouse, the other yesterday at the new distribution site in southern Gaza. The Americans and Israelis have sought to portray these chaotic scenes as a minor blip. Now today, gunfire has prevented many hungry Gazans from even reaching the distribution center. Aid agencies and the majority of nations refuse to back the new plan on the grounds that it's inadequate and inhumane. It also looks extremely dangerous for those in need. John Irvine, News at 10, Tel Aviv.
So this is vile, disgusting, appalling, abusive, ridiculous, horrific. The idea here, it seems to be, is that make them starve, then tell them that there's a bit of food over there, and then you can maybe shoot them or kill them as they try and get it.
Well, that's right. And of course...
isn't that how you kill animals, rats and things like that? Well, you just put down a little bit of rat bait, and then maybe you can put it in a trap, shoot it, kill it, or whatever. This is what they're doing to people in Gaza.
That's right. And of course... Keir Starmer and Nigel Farage are all in favour of it.
And what about Kerry Badenoch?
Oh, she's in favour of it too.
And what about the Greens?
Well, the Greens aren't, actually. That's one of the reasons. One of the reasons why the Labour Party is losing votes. We were talking about their opinion poll share earlier. Yeah. Most of the votes they're losing are on the left.
Anyway, we could go on and on about the horrors there, and often we do, but I just look at it as a... You know, particularly the Russians being pushed out of the equation in the Middle East by the Ukraine battle, by the British. So we, again, it seems to me, to be the aggressors everywhere. What are the British up to? Why are we supporting this? And we say we don't support it, but we do, don't we? We do. I don't know if anyone saw Question Time BBC last night. They had some... Labour minister who was just getting a hell of a time from the audience, particularly one member of the audience, is saying, well, what are you going to do to stop it? You know, and there's no real answer. Well, we're doing everything. Well, you know, you're not doing everything you can, are you? And of course you're not. You're just lying through your teeth. So the Brits are very much involved in all of these problems, particularly the Ukraine and the Gaza ones. But we're going to look at something quite different now. And I suppose it's the home front, really, in the way, you know, I'm always talking on about, going on about the way that the King Tampon Charlie, and I don't know if anyone noticed last week at the beginning of the programme, there's that famous tape, the Camilla Gate tape, a bit of that, because you don't often hear that. In fact, it was quite difficult to find. You see if you can find the whole thing and send it to me, but because I only managed to find that kind of fragment of the cheeky conversation overheard between Charles and Camilla. I don't, you know, in a way, it's quite a humorous conversation, but it's a bit sort of creepy as well. You don't want to hear it too many times. But, you know, they're at war with us. And so here's another example of how they're at war with us. This guy is actually not here. It wasn't here in Britain, but it was involving a British bank, Lloyds Bank. And his name is Daryl Kavanagh. He was a nightclub owner in Waterford in Ireland. And he found that the Bank of Scotland completely destroyed his business. He was a very successful businessman over there, running one of the biggest nightclubs in Ireland. And in fact, he built it up from a small business with a successful formula. Very nice places, apparently, they were to go and visit too. But he was destroyed by the banks, who took all of his stuff off him, and he's now fighting back. Well, he has been for the best part of the last decade. So let's hear him tell a bit of his story. Daryl Kavanagh here, destroyed by the Bank of Scotland, and this is how.
I was asked to go and see my bank manager in Bank of Scotland in Waterford with a girl called Emer Fagan. His name was John Fagan. She was Emer Dalton. So myself and my brother went in, and my another brother had opened a business on the Dunmore Road. I had previously said to the manager of Bank of Scotland before he retired, Jim Ryan, who was a fantastic friend of our families, and really supported us and brought us to where we were before we were destroyed, I should say. But they called us in and they said, look, you're going to have to take over your brother's business. And I said, no, what? No, I said, I told Jim, you know, years ago, not to lend him money under any circumstances. Not that they shouldn't lend him money, but I didn't want it associated with our business. You know, he should do business somewhere else. We had the relationship. So I said, no. He said, if you do not take over this loan, you will never open Mantra. So to make a long story short, we had no choice. It was 2008. There was people jumping out through windows.
And so this was part of your mission to take your successful business model closer to Dublin, really.
Well, yes, that's right. That's what they were trying. That's what they were blackmailing me with. I was probably 3 months off opening that club, and I knew it was going to be a massive success. Maynooth has one of the biggest universities in Ireland. It's a short hop from Dublin. It's a commute. It's got big residential around it. I knew I was onto something good. Most people would have looked at Maynooth and they would have said the population is 5,000. I didn't look at it like that. I looked at it was a magnet. Mantra was a magnet. And the opening night, there was a queue 1 mile long. They had to bring in police from Dublin. We had Sophie Ellis-Bextor opened it for us. All the Coronation Street stars were there. You know, it was huge. You know, all the big sports personalities. I can name, they're all there. You know, the rugby players, they were all there. So it was a massive, massive success. And it turned over €150,000 every single week up to the time that I was called again into Bank of Scotland. Now, the second time I was called in, they told me that I had to start paying interest and capital, even though we had just opened Mantra and we had a deal for 1 year. And I said, look, this is too much. We're in a financial crisis. I've taken over my brother's business. You know, you're really pushing. I'm giving you 20,000 every month, every single month. And we are stuck in the middle of a financial crisis. I said, no, I'm not doing it. I just stood firm. And that's what they wanted. They defaulted my loans. They appointed a receiver. They had a pre-pact. They phoned me the next morning and they had appointed receivers to all of our pubs based on the fact that we were insolvent, because we had taken over a company that was insolvent, my brother's company, which they had blackmailed us into taking over.
Now, were there debts? What did your brother have debts that you didn't realize know about?
Well, it wasn't even about the debts. It's about the fact that I was asked, like the business that he had was no way related to what we did. We were into big clubs, we were into city centre pubs. This was a pub in a suburb of Waterford, a good suburb of Waterford, but not a place where I would want to have a pub. You've got to be there all the time. It's very personal. Not our business. You know, that's it. End of story. I wouldn't talk
about
it.
No, I understand that, but yeah, can you just talk a bit about this crucial point about figures? So how much a debt did this company of your brother's have, and how much did you have coming in? What was your arrangement about paying the loans back to Bank of Scotland?
Okay, so at the time it wasn't trading well at all. It never really worked. And basically what we had to do was go in, try and turn it around. I did what I did with Harvey's. I took a portion of the roof off the back. I tried to incorporate a smoking area into it. We refurbished the bar and refitted it, but it just didn't work. It's a very cliquey area, and there's a very bad element on the Dunmore Road. The guys, the haters, the jealousers, the ones that don't like you driving a nice car, they all go out there.
Yeah, so with hindsight, that was just the wrong spot.
It was the wrong spot. They should never have given him the money. It was reckless lending. They did not look at where he was opening the pub. They did not look at whether he would work in the pub. It was a disaster. It was reckless lending. Coming back to what you were saying about how much was it, I think he owed about 1.2 at the time. The pub was not worth that. It had no revenue. It was only doing about 1,500 quid a week, and he paid 1.2 million for it.
So when the Bank of Scotland first talked to you about this, did you think, yeah, this is doable, we can sort this out, we can sort that other debt out? Because they're suddenly turning around to you and saying, oh, you've defaulted, matey.
Well, I'll put it to you like this, right? I only took over the debt. I took over the debt. I probably did a little bit because my brother was there, but I took it over because it was going to destroy me if they moved on Mantra. But I knew that once I was only paying interest as per the deal that we had with them, that I would probably be able to subsidize the Cove. And when we came out of the financial crash, I could probably buy it out at a discount. That's what I was thinking. That way I got Mantra open. I kept my brother out of any trouble. We honored all our creditors and everybody had a happy ending. That wasn't Bank of Scotland's plan at all. Bank of Scotland's plan was through Michael McAteer of Grant Thornton, who they had a prearranged receivership with. The plan was to grab the turnover from Mantra, and they did that. They ran it for 4 years until they drained it, until they ruined it, and then it was sold on. Now, I was involved when it came up for sale again with two guys who just took advantage of the fact that I had to declare bankruptcy because I thought I was bankrupt. But the fact about it was
that... Just before you jump ahead too far, when did you realise that actually that Mantra was gone and you were all this effort that you put in, that the bank had taken it off you?
Yeah. So when they appointed the receiver, immediately I consulted a lawyer and we challenged it in the High Court in Ireland. And we applied for examinership, which would have given us 120 days to get everything right and go back. So we were granted receivership because we were so strong. And the judge in the case, Judge Kelly, asked for a report on our business and ordered Bank of Scotland to pay for that report. Now, when he got that report back, when he had to decide whether we were getting examinership or not, that report was scathing for Bank of Scotland, and it said that our business was one of the most profitable, most well-run hospitality businesses they had ever seen. And we had 300 people working for us. You know, we had 10, nearly 15 million turnover a year. You know, we were going really well. So the judge said at that hearing, he said, I'm awarding examinership and I'm halving your debt. I'm knocking your debt down by half. Go, Mr. Kavanagh, get the money, come back to me, and I'm going to support you 100%. a guy related to me was supposed to get the money. He was supposed to deliver it. It was the only chance I had. And I also found out about a scheme in Spain where I could raise money. I sent down 790,000 through my solicitor in Waterford. And it was lost because somebody in the bank was working with the company raising the bond and they took the million. That wiped me out completely. So when I went back for the examinership, I was nearly €1 million lighter. My lawyer never brought up the fact that Bank of Scotland had forced us to take over a debt and the examinership fell. And that is exactly what happened. Now, I am, as I said, in the process of overturning my bankruptcy at the moment. And that is one of the things that will be addressed during that.
Well, he's still fighting. And in fact, he's saying, oh, maybe I wasn't bankrupt. But anyway, he's being shoved through the courts. Martin, basically, is perfectly reasonable business. The banks of what they called, I suppose this is a kind of bait and switch, where what they do is they say, well, there's no reason why they should say, well, you're going to have to include your brother's dodgy company in this loan agreement, otherwise the loan falls. Well, they'd already agreed to the loan. The money was already being spent at this point. So they've injected in there something toxic into this loan agreement, which they know is going to mean that they can go then and grab his assets.
Yeah, well, obviously it's quite a complicated story, isn't it?
But in a way, it's not. It's a simple story of somebody who's running a very successful nightclub business who's had it stolen off of them by the bank.
Yeah, well, Royal Bank of Scotland was, of course, nationalised at one stage.
Well, this is Bank of Scotland, which is not the same as Royal Bank of Scotland. But anyway, the point of the matter really here is that the banks at the time were just looking to grab assets, weren't they?
Yes, because, of course, they've got big holes in their balance sheet.
So, anyway, that's the case of the banks stealing loads of people's viable businesses was a subject of that Panorama documentary that we had a few, was it about 2 or 3 weeks ago? Similar thing here in the Bristol, in the in Lloyds Bank. And, of course, Lloyds Bank own HBOS, Halifax Bank of Scotland, owned by Lloyds, which I didn't realise. And as part of that documentary, which were aired on Panorama, there's a particular BBC lawyer who shall, for the time being, remain nameless, who refused to let the Police and Crime Commissioner of Thames Valley Police, who's also an ex-army officer, who is very supportive of these victims of Lloyds and wants to see more prosecutions of fraud here in this country, of banks. And his name is Anthony Stansfield. I spoke to him, though, and this is he's the guy that the BBC edited out of that documentary. And I asked him a few things, including, what did you say in the documentary that the BBC edited out? But most importantly, as if anyone owns a business or is running a business, what should you be aware of with the banks? Because they can trick you into losing that business.
Be very, very careful which bank you borrow money from, I think, and make absolutely certain that you haven't had, and ask the bank whether bank accounts have been opened in your name that you're not aware of.
Well, that is not the sort of question that you would think to ask, is it? Have you been opening bank accounts in my name that I'm not aware of?
Well, it's quite extraordinary, yes. And I would like, there should have been a proper government investigation into what went on. But I think the government, successive governments, have been so keen not to rock the boat with the banks. They've lent them so much money, or given them so much money, that they have basically had a free hand to do what they'd wanted to do.
Well, look, it sounds to me like you're saying that even with maybe new frauds which are invented, fraud is no longer a criminal offence in Britain.
It doesn't seem to be.
That's almost as if Britain is becoming a fraud capital, that any fraudster can come here and merrily ply their craft to the expense of the community.
Yes, I mean, it is extraordinary. I think, you know, a few minor local frauds the police investigate. But, I mean, the only reason, really, for the existence of the City of London Police was to examine fraud. They don't even do it today. When did the City of London last take on a major fraud? And the answer is not for years, as far as I can see. The Metropolitan Police, I don't think we have that pool of skilled police officers who have any idea of banking or how to take on a major fraud that emanates out of the banking system. The system is very, very weak. And those regulatory authorities that should be doing something about it, National Crime Agency, Financial Conduct Authority, the Bank of England, basically look the other way and will do anything to support the bank.
Well, you mentioned the City of London there. This is an interesting thing we've got here in Britain, which even the monarch apparently has to write to them beforehand if he wants to visit the City of London. It's almost like a country within a country. The other thing here, of course, is the legal profession. So what sort of networks are there? Because it seems clear to me that the banking industry is so powerful in this country, it's able to slowly but surely change the judiciary and even pressurise the press, the media, the National London media, into being almost part of a protection racket.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, if you actually look how much our major banks, notably Lloyds, spend on lawyers a year, it is a vast sum. And the money is hoovered up by about four or five of the major legal companies in London. And one of the pernicious things that I've seen on a few occasions is that when somebody actually gets lawyers on their behalf to try and take on a bank, and one or two people, even tried to do, had offers of people to do it pro bono, because they haven't got any money themselves, that smaller legal company will be lent upon by the big ones. And they pull out usually. And this is a real problem. There is a very nasty little network there.
Well, it's talking about, that sounds to me like a perversion of the course of justice. These, again, seem to be even bigger offences in themselves. You're describing a kind of lawless nation.
Yes, I think, we always used to pride ourselves on being a very honest country. I think that went out of the window after Big Bang, and things went realised that they could get away with these sort of crimes.
But that's back to Margaret Thatcher. I think it was about 1991, isn't it? That's a long time ago.
It's a long, long time ago, and I think it didn't happen straight away. It worked its way up slowly through the system. But I think by the middle of 2005, 2006, they had really discovered that they could get away with practically anything. And I think they have. And I think, we have a very, unfortunately, corrupt system today. And it's very worrying.
Well, it certainly is. The banks, of course, if they were here with us, they would say that we are self-regulating through the, I think, isn't it, the Financial Services Authority, at their own regulator.
Yeah, yes. And whose pocket are they in? I mean, I took this to Andrew Bailey, who ran. I had meetings with him. I had the correspondence. We had one-to-one meeting on this, and he demanded that every single one of these cases go to him personally. Not one single one came out.
Now, he's the governor of the Bank of England.
Exactly.
So that's good old Anthony Stansfield there. He was the Police and Crime Commissioner in Thames Valley. He also was instrumental in organising the, because Reading is in Thames Valley Police's area, a massive prosecution, I think it was of HSBC, I'm maybe wrong, maybe it was HBOS, in Reading, where a whole bunch of bankers go to jail. And he gives me quite an entertaining account of that trial, where Martin, the bankers that were closing down companies, stealing companies, defrauding documents, setting up illegal bank accounts, forging signatures, and all this sort of thing, that to take these companies off people, they were spending the money on drugs, on women, and on fine holidays all around the world.
Well, it's a sad tale, isn't it? But of course, the key to this is, as he said, the Big Bang in the 1980s.
And well, just give us what was the Big Bang for those that don't know.
Well, I mean, in the 1930s, because of the excesses of the capitalist system and the crash in 1929, banking was fairly strictly regulated. There were things they couldn't do, and you know they were basically not allowed to innovate in the way that they wanted, and all the rest of it. And of course, that's one of Margaret Thatcher's baleful legacies: is this whole, you know, the creation of a system of fraud. And of course, that ultimately led directly to the 2008 crisis. And you know, we are living through the consequences of all these poor decisions that were made in that era, and the negative consequences are now playing out.
These are not just poor decisions; they are great decisions for certain people who are acquiring vast amounts of assets and wealth in this country, and basically predating, parasiting on the rest of us.
Well, that's right.
So they are rubbing their hands. Never mind bad decisions for them; they're perfect decisions.
That's right. I mean, as we know, the whole COVID pandemic, plandemic, whatever you want to call it, ended up with the billionaires being even better off than they were before. And they were better off at the end of the crisis in 2008. That all the pain of all of this has been dumped on ordinary people, which is why, you know, some people actually end up dodging their fares on the tube because they can't afford it.
Well, I also spoke to the full version of that interview with Anthony Stansfield, where he talks a lot about all the stuff that the BBC lawyers edited out of Panorama. I think I shall have to put that up on YouTube or something so that anyone who's interested in that Panorama programme can go and see exactly what the BBC lawyer... he's talking there about these networks of lawyers. I mean, this smells of Freemasonry to me and organised crime. The idea is that these lawyers are actually part of a criminal network, including this lawyer inside the BBC. And they're saying, oh, well, the BBC can't take on Lloyds Bank. It can't take on some of these individuals that are being accused in Panorama. Why not? Why can't you take them on, BBC? If you think that Anthony Stansfield is lying or he's got it all wrong, then say so and explain why. But you can't, can you? Because you're cowards and you're part of the criminal network, BBC lawyer. Well, maybe in the next few weeks, we will name our nice little BBC lawyer that's done all this. So I also spoke this week to Catherine Gunn, and she's the whistleblower from the Iraq War, worked at GCHQ. She keeps a very close eye on everything. I think, if you remember during COVID, she was on almost every week on this programme, giving us a brilliant update on what had been going on throughout the world. And many of those videos did extremely well before YouTube shut down one of my channels. So everyone was getting a lot of good information from her. I just think she's a fascinating source of information on all sorts of things. She's now in Turkey most of the time. But I asked her about this very question, about this idea of the great transformation. What is going on in the financial system? Because obviously, as Martin is always talking about a crash, well, what is going to emerge from the other side of a crash? You can be absolutely sure these satanic banksters have planned absolutely 100% to take over with a new system.
The great transformation is that sometime in the UK in the 1800s, this new economic model was established whereby the market was everything. So it's this sort of concept of the market will look after everything, and the market is in no way connected to, the environment it's in, or the social, structure, the religion, the sort of, you know, community. And it's not connected to any of that. It's a separate entity in and of itself alone. And the pursuit of this sort of free market enterprise, what it does is it inevitably becomes fascistic, because eventually everyone has a price, anything can be bought and sold, and you know people become sort of just shells of themselves, and there are no bonds anymore between people. So in the UK, what they did at the time, unlike in other countries in Europe, which is why, you know, there was a much more, apparently, there was a more kind of massive upheaval in Europe. But in the UK, what the parliamentarians did was they could see this huge mass of people who'd suddenly been deprived of a way of feeding themselves. And so they brought in something called the poor laws. And so they were literally giving people money to do nothing. And that had the effect of making people completely and utterly demoralized. So it was sort of a catch-22, but it kind of, Karl Polanyi argues that this is what prevented a massive civil uprising and a massive sort of revolution in the UK, is because the poor were kept just so, you know, carefully controlled with a little sufficient amount of money to keep them ticking over. And in order to push through the agendas 2030, they're talking about, you know, universal basic income and so on, because they know that that the way they intend for AI to work and for digitization to work and robotics to work is that 40 or more percent of the population will not be employable on their terms. And so what will they do with all the people who are not employable? And so, of course, all the bleeding heart. Well, the bleeding heart liberals say, well, we need a universal basic income. But then if that's attached to things like, you know, a digital wallet and a digital ID, which is essentially what they want. So basically, you know, this commodification process just keeps going on and on and on. And when they've privatized and commodified nature, you know, what else will they privatize and commodify? Who knows? You know, they're running out of options here. Are they going to commodify the moon and privatize it? I mean, what exactly is the end of this? The fact is, it's anti-human. It's anti, so society, basically. And they know it is. And so they're devising ways in order to keep people divided and distracted so they don't focus on these issues. And they're devising ways to kill off people who are basically, according to them, useless eaters, and a drain on the public purse. And so everything is being manipulated in this way for these end goals of controlling people in these little human settlements, where they won't be able to rebel, where they won't revolt, and they will have the play of the land. They will have it all.
Well, it sounds like this sort of own nothing and be happy world.
Well, yeah, and to go back to, you know, basically this article by Ian Davis called The Not So Great Carbon Reset, he actually quotes from a meeting that was held by all the G7 central bankers at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in August of 2019. And August of 2019 is also the month that the WEF signed a memorandum of understanding with that WBCS, Sustainable Development, the world, whatever, that organization that was mentioned in the documentary. And so everything basically was being set up in August 2019 for the takeover. And what BlackRock said at this meeting at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, they use this term going direct, and they explain it. They said going direct means the central bank finding ways to get central bank money directly in the hands of public and private sector spenders. Going direct works by enforcing policy coordination so that the fiscal expansion does not lead to an offsetting increase in interest rates. So what basically central bank money doesn't have a way of going into non-bank sectors. And so they use the pseudo-pandemic, the COVID pandemic, to get private money into public hands. And he goes on to explain that this is a global coup d'etat. The government you elect no longer controls how it spends your taxed income. Central banks do, and they will do as directed by private money. That's what he says. And he says that, you know, the global public-private partnership, and the public-private partnership, as described during the Blairite years, was the third way, wasn't it? And basically, it's a network of corporations, privately funded think tanks, intergovernmental organizations, financial institutions, non-governmental organizations, philanthropic foundations, and governments, academic institutions, civil society groups, media organizations, private investors, and so on. I mean, it's all of those things. He says it's hierarchical, compartmentalized, and an authoritarian structure. And I think this is what happened in 2019. Well, at the end of 2019, when they started this COVID nonsense, and it's carried on in different guises. And, you know, as I, a video I listened to recently, a talk that Alon Mizrahi gave last week, and he says, what's going on in Gaza is beyond the realm of politics. And I think, you know, this is basically what's happened, is that we're no longer in the realm of politics because of this coup d'etat. The central bankers are in control and they're dictating policy. And so I don't know what your chap that you were talking about, Steve.
Steve Hall, yeah. I mean, yeah. He's saying similar things in that what he's saying that one of the first things that governments need to do is to renationalize much of the national infrastructure, which I think most people would agree with. In fact, quite a lot of Tory voters agree with it, amazingly, even though they might have a picture on the wall.
Right. I mean, because the thing is, in this, as Ian goes on to describe in his article, he says, in this fluid model of global governance, global think tanks coordinate and develop policy agendas in partnership with central banks, the Bank for International Settlements, and other key stakeholders, intergovernmental organizations and global financial institutions, then promote the agenda before national government, these are the enforcement partners, convert it into hard policy and often legislation. Policy propagandists, such as the mainstream media and hybrid warfare specialists, which includes people like GCHQ, then sell the policy on to the public. We are then subjected to the policies that originated at the top global public-private partnership level. So, yeah, we've really, countries that have been fighting for years to keep their utilities under public control and all of this sort of thing are always fighting an uphill battle. And, you know, this is precisely, I mean, the UK has just gone down and down and down. And what they're trying to do now, I think, so if we're referring to these central bankers, essentially, and the people that work for them, what they're trying to do is, in the UK, is to push reform forward. And I think this whole business about Starmer and the three Ukrainians, obviously this is just my theory, but I think it is an attempt to gradually lay the foundations to get him out of government or out of number 10. And eventually, you know, swing the nation so far against woke issues and against migration issues. So they're weaponizing those issues, deliberately making people feel like those are the issues that are absolutely top of the agenda, so that someone like Farage or someone of his ilk will be able to walk into number 10. That's what I think they're trying to do.
So that's the GCHQ whistleblower. Hero of the making the Iraq war an illegal war, Catherine Gunn there speaking to me from Turkey earlier this week, and pretty much putting it all in perspective. I think she takes this very long view, wide view, Martin. She doesn't really seem to agree with you about there being a great big crash. She says what's happening is the entire world's finance is being slowly restructured without us hardly even noticing.
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting point of view. I think she's put too much emphasis. Central banks are essentially the creatures of the private banking cartel.
But are they? Are they? Are they? Are they? Because they're in charge of regulation. And as we heard earlier from Anthony Stansfield, they're supposed to be in charge of regulation. But, maybe you're right. He didn't do anything, Andrew Bailey, did he?
That's
with
right.
all these frauds.
That's right. So, in other words, the central banks are definitely a brick in the wall.
So, who's in charge?
The banksters. The people who own the banks. And that's, we're talking about Jamie Dimon. We're talking about the tech bros.
Diamond.
The wealthy elite. They own everything via Vanguard and BlackRock.
It's a fascinating chat, right? I think I found it fascinating chatting with Catherine, mostly listening to her, not interrupting her too much, like I'm always interrupting you, Martin. She talks about all sorts there, particularly, I think that she's one of those people, a bit like you and I, Martin, who likes to take a bigger picture look at everything. The idea is the mainstream press keeps you focused on the story in hand. And actually what's really going on is, I think, far more interesting, which is enormous structural changes in society, sometimes over hundreds of years even.
Yes, well, I mean, you know, it's quite obvious that everything's connected to everything else, and that what's happened in the past determines very largely the choices that we face
in the
present.
I'll put a link up to the Ian Davis article she mentioned, this whole idea of the Great Transformation. This sounds a little bit like the Great Reset, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, they have got their goal of, you know, dominating the 21st
economic,
century.
What we discuss later on that, if you want to listen to it, folks, is economic slavery. This is actually what it's about. It's about depriving people of any kind of ability to make a living. And so that, yes, you might get universal basic income, but you don't behave yourself, you're going to starve. But like the people in Gaza. Maybe they'll shoot you too.
Yes, I mean, I think universal basic income has got a variety of different potential, it's got potential goals of it. It could be used to control people, quite obviously, but then existing benefits are used to control people. You know, you're not just given money, they make you jump through hoops for it. And that's the basic discipline of capitalist society. What may happen is that they're actually going to get rid of lots of people. So what we're seeing in Gaza could actually end up being we haven't talked about Trump's tariff merry-go-round this
week. Well,
we've
been talking about it. Everyone else is talking about it. We don't need to talk
about
it.
Well, I mean, yeah, except...
Anyway, we know what's going on with Trump. It's all chaotic,
yes,
which is exactly what like the Israelis want to see.
Well, yes, but also, of course, what it's doing is it's going to bankrupt various developing countries. Because they cannot pay the debts, their dollar debts, if they're not allowed to sell into the United States.
Well, they also
States.
Just don't know what's happening.
Well,
of course,
indeed.
A company cannot plan if it doesn't know what's happening.
Yes, well, what's going to happen is we're going to have a massive third world debt crisis, and big countries are going to default, which then, of course, may then lead to the crashing of the banking system.
Now, I'm getting a bit of deja vu with Elon Musk, because apparently I thought he'd left Doge, but apparently he's only just left Doge. Do you hear anything about this, Martin?
Well, it's hard to know what's going on, isn't it? Because it's like...
So fast, they're breaking things.
Yes, they're moving fast and breaking things. And that is our... You know, what they're breaking is our security and our future.
So, yes, apparently that's just been happening live. About 2 hours ago, Musk's Doge exit live. Donald Trump and Tesla chief executive are going to speak from the White House, so it'd be interesting to see what they've had to say. Well, and they said, is it going to be interesting to see what they've got to say? I mean, surely Musk likes to think he's hardwiring the US government so that he can have his little bits of software and algorithms running the whole thing.
Well, that's right, but of course, you know, they're running into the practicality political difficulties. I mean, you know, because you can't just cut government. This is, you know, Farage saying, well, I'm just going to cut waste in government. But it's not that easy. You know, if it was that easy, to, you know, once you get rid of, you know, what you think of as waste, you know, people who look after sewers, for example, or whatever it is, you suddenly find the sewers don't work. There's a reason why governments spend money, because a lot of what they're providing is essential but hardly glamorous.
So the Daryl Kavanagh interview, that will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which is all about his amazing businesses over in Ireland that the bank stole from him fraudulently, and yet nothing is done about these things, because that's just the world we live in. Unless you're in with the in crowd, which is the blue blood bankers, you can do what you want, apparently, and steal people's businesses like that, break the law left, right and centre. Then we also have the Anthony Stansfield interview, which is all about the stuff that he was edited out of by the BBC lawyer, who will remain nameless. And finally, the Catherine Gunn interview, the full interview with her, which is nearly an hour long. So lots and lots of chit-chat in there about all sorts of things, but particularly the bigger picture. But we're going to finish tonight, Martin, by wrapping up the story from 2 weeks ago. You quite rightly pointed out, well, what happened next? Do you want to just say something a little bit about the situation at the time with the guy, was it Danny...
Anthony Scapitacci.
No, the guy who was
Danny
Morrison. So we left him because this is an amazing piece. It's a 7.5 hour program made by the BBC all about Steak Knife, and it was made specifically because Steak Knife died last year. This is Frank Scapitacci, who was a British Army agent, who was in charge of killing IRA. Executing IRA so-called traitors, but many of them, of course, he was being ordered to do this by the British Army, and so they would have been not traitors. So this was a horrific thing going on at the top of the IRA, right the way through the troubles with Scapitacci in charge. The way we left it, he was about to enter a building, wasn't he, to do a press conference with another guy. I think it was somebody Lynch. I can't remember his name. You'll hear it in a minute. Who had been being interrogated by Scapitacci, who had confessed to being a British Army agent. And it may well be that Scapitacci had been fed information by the British Army, which let him know that he'd been compromised, Martin. So this is very sneaky, isn't it? So you've got someone who's pretending to be from the IRA, interrogating someone and saying, we think you're a British agent, we know this, we know that. But actually, the we is the British Army. It's not the IRA at all.
Well, that's right. And of course, Brigadier Gordon Kerr's Force Research Unit has Scapitacci on their books.
Well, they're right the way through this
documentary. And the same Brian Nelson, who's the Chief Intelligence Officer of the UDA, was also a British Army agent.
Well, let's finish off this little story and I'll let you know what happened to Danny Morrison as he went into the house where he was supposed to be having a press conference about this guy who just confessed to being a British Army agent.
1990. Sandy Lynch, as we know, is taken to the house on Carrigart Avenue on the Friday night. Danny Morrison isn't at the house yet. Freddie Scapitacci is.
Unfortunately, for Sandy Lynch, when the Scap's interrogating them, Scap's a British agent interrogating another British agent, Sandy Lynch breaks and admits to a number of offences.
According to Danny Morrison, the reason he's going to the house is to assess Sandy Lynch. Morrison is the Sinn Féin director of publicity, and the idea is that they're going to hold a press conference about Sandy Lynch, where the informer will talk to the media about his activities and how he was recruited by British intelligence.
I was concerned about the circumstances of the house that I was going to at this stage, because although I had been told that the IRA had left the scene, and that Lynch agreed to do this press conference. As a director of publicity, and I had introduced informers to press conferences before, I wanted to ensure that the person who I was meeting, whom I had never met before, whom I still haven't met, I was concerned that he could be turned into a Walter Mitty. And there was no way was I going to put him on in a press conference if he turned out to be a Walter Mitty.
Sorry, Dan, you said you were told that the IRA had left the scene.
Yes.
How is that possible?
This is what I was told, that the IRA had left the scene and that to go to the house, and that Lynch would be there with other Republicans, some of whom I also knew. So, for example, Jared Hodgkins,
who was in the house had been a press officer for me in the Republican Press Center. And
was a member of the IRA.
I'm not sure if he was ever sentenced for IRA membership. I know he was charged. He was an ex-prisoner, but he had been on the blanket.
But he would tell you himself that he was a member of the IRA.
Well, I'm not saying he was a member of the IRA. The other person...
He told me he was a member of the IRA, you know.
Danny Morrison arrived at the house at 5:10 in the evening. The door was unlocked.
The door was open, as many doors are in nationalist areas. We went into the hallway.
Literally the moment he arrived, as soon as he walked across the threshold, there was a wall of sirens.
I realised something was wrong. I ran through the house. I ran out the back door into the garden, where a soldier popped up from the next garden and called upon me to halt. I climbed over the fence and went in the next door. The back door was open, and I went into that house.
Danny Morrison sat in a stranger's kitchen while the house next door was being raided.
I told them that the British Army, or there was going to be a raid on the house, and would they say that I had been there for half an hour? I remained there, and the Brits had called upon me to halt. They obviously knew that someone had entered the next house. It was at this stage that the Brits and the RUC entered the house.
Right.
And then they nominated the RUC man to arrest me, and I was taken away.
The rescue of the agent Sandy Lynch was a big story in Northern Ireland.
On the 7th of January last year, the police moved in. It was, said a police source, nothing more than an educated guess.
And it was a big story because Danny Morrison was a high-profile arrest, one of the most influential voices in Sinn Féin and the Republican movement.
Security sources say the trial has brought Lynch's finest moment as an informer. The conviction of Danny Morrison, described by intelligence sources as a leading member of the IRA.
Yes, it was a coup for them to take me off the scene and whatever influence I had.
He told police that Kevin Mulgrew was leader of his Belfast Brigade staff unit. Mulgrew is now living outside the jurisdiction. Others mentioned by Lynch, and the man named only as Scapatici, who was part of the team of IRA interrogators, are also now outside Northern Ireland. All are wanted for questioning by the police.
Anybody who had been in that house as part of the IRA operation and who wasn't arrested obviously fell under suspicion. And Freddie Scapatici, who was subsequently named in court by Sandy Lynch, the man who was interrogated, he was one of the suspects, obviously. Anybody that was in the house that Lynch could identify fled south.
Danny Morrison was sentenced to 8 years while Freddie Scapatici fled Northern Ireland, crossing the border and hiding out in Dublin until, as we know, the alibi over the fingerprints on the debugger was concocted.
Then he came out and he was back living in Belfast with his wife. But this whole steak knife thing, by the way, in 1990, you're talking about different mindsets here. In 1990, when the whole time that we were in jail, I never heard of the word steak knife.
It was in 1993, while Danny Morrison was in prison, that Freddie Scapatici contacted the producers of the Cook Report, alleging he had information about Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness.
Hello.
Hello, Frank?
Yes.
Yes. I've been in touch with Central.
And remember, this audio wouldn't be leaked until 10 years later. But the recordings in the Culloden Hotel car park happened only 3 years after the Sandy Lynch affair.
He thinks he's being smart, contributing to the denigration of Martin McGuinness, but they have secretly taped him in a car at the Culloden Hotel.
I'll explain the fact that McGuinness is on the IRA Army Council, right?
Yeah. He also controls the Northern Command, which takes in the main counties of Ulster.
Right. While in the car park of the Culloden, the reporters bring up certain Republican figures. One of the first names they suggest to Scappaticci is Danny Morrison.
But what they've basically done is they've caught up the Northern Command area. Right?
Since Danny Morrison went there.
No, Danny Morrison had nothing to do with it.
Right.
Nothing to do with it. He was director of publicity, but he was also in the IRA Army Council. But he had no balls.
Scappaticci says Morrison is on the Army Council of the IRA. He says he has no balls.
He's a pen pusher, if you want to put it that way.
He then calls him a pen pusher.
In that tape, he said some disparaging things about you. Danny Morrison had nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. He was the director of publicity, but he was also in the IRA Army Council. But he had no balls, basically. He was a pen pusher, if you want to put it that way.
A very proud pen pusher as well.
Well, why was there animosity there?
Well, I...
Do you think?
I have no idea. I mean, it's not just animosity against me. The point about it is he's an agent. And I don't know whether he had heart and soul gone over to the enemy to such an extent that he was proud of his work with British intelligence and demonised his own community, an oppressed community, a community that had suffered. And he was being rewarded for being a traitor. So that explains it. I mean, he just doesn't speak about me. My understanding is he speaks about other people as well.
And see that woman that came on? She was writing what she said, like he is an evil person.
Yeah.
Yes.
I had no personal interaction with him. I was never in a pub with him where he came off with a dirty joke where I could make a judgment about him or where he said something snide about another comrade. I was never in his company to get inside his personality. You know, you hear reports that he was a bully. You hear reports that he was disliked. That's all well and good. I can only speak for myself. But I think the back of the car in the Culloden sums up exactly, right, where he was at. What can I do now? I know. I phone up the Cook Report and I run down Adams and McGuinness as somebody who's in the IRA.
So that's Danny Morrison, his account of, he was jailed for quite a considerable period of time there, set up by the British Army and by two of their agents, Martin.
Well, that's right. It was a very dirty war. And, of course, what's happened this week is that Gerry Adams sued the BBC because they claimed in another documentary that he was responsible for giving the order to assassinate Donaldson, who was on the IRA Army Council, but was another British agent who ended up being assassinated in Donegal. But
reminds me a lot of this of the environmental groups being totally infiltrated.
Well,
I mean,
right,
is there anything going on which hasn't been infiltrated by the Army or the Metropolitan Police?
Well, I mean, this was a problem for the Republican movement all along. And any kind of clandestine movement like that, it's going to be a problem. Because if it's clandestine...
Would you blame any of the leaders, the judgment of the leaders, trusting that people like Scappaticci?
Well, yes, but I mean,
He had a decision about life and death.
Well, exactly. But I mean, the point is, from the point of view of legality and morality, is that the British Army were encouraged... You know, the people who were their agents were allowed to kill. And, of course, they did kill. Scappaticci killed several people. Mm. But he was allowed to do it because he was a British agent.
I mean,
Brian Nelson was the head of the UDA. He was given the targets that the army wanted the UDA to kill, and he went out and killed them. So the British actually set up those people to be murdered. So when you talk about the IRA being a violent organisation, which it clearly was, the British Army was a violent organisation. They were manipulating all of these things, which is one very good reason why everybody wised up and realised that probably wasn't the way to go. And, of course, what Gerry Adams has won his libel case in the court in Dublin yesterday was that he didn't have any role in the decision to kill Donaldson.
And this guy, Donaldson?
Well, Donaldson was a senior IRA person. He wouldn't be known very well outside the organisation. He was nobody famous, but they would know who he was. And it turned out that he'd been a British agent for years. The way they got him was that he was actually having an affair with one of his comrades' wives, and the British found out about it, and they said, well, you wouldn't want so-and-so to find out that you're having sex with his wife, would you? And he's not going to find out because you're going to be our agent.
Well, anybody who's interested in the Irish War, I mean, that's a book, isn't it? Tony Geraghty's book.
Yeah, Tony Geraghty's book, The Irish War. Well, that's about the whole history of the war in Ireland, going back to the, you know...
Cromwell
and all
or
the
even before, possibly. Yeah. Didn't you tell me an interesting story about a chapter of that which was taken out? Because that's
well, no, it wasn't taken
tale.
Out. What happened, there was a chapter in it which was about how MI5 carried out observations. Yeah, it was lots of
sort of
technical stuff. Yeah. And he'd actually interviewed, because he interviewed for the
book. They were having various surveillance teams, and then one team would be swapped for another team.
So explain
how many people
were in
the team, how they made it impossible for you or difficult for you to figure out you were actually being followed.
Yeah, so there was quite a lot of detail in it. And he went to the MI5 and the army, because he interviewed everybody for the book. Because he'd been in the Parachute Regiment, but he was also part of the Sunday Times Insight team, which had exposed Bloody Sunday.
Which is how the British Army started the whole thing.
Well, not really. It had already started by that stage. It was just a continuation of what was going
really
on.
Kicked it off.
Because of the massacre in the Ballymurphy massacres in Belfast had been going on before that, and most people haven't heard about them, and they went on for several days. Just 20 minutes.
I did interrupt you. You were talking about Tony Geraghty and his getting this book together.
The chapter in the book was about how MI5, it's called the Kiss the Dead Drop. I can't remember the title of the chapter, but it was basically about how MI5 carried out their observations. And he went to MI5 and said, and he interviewed people, and they said, well, it's fine, you can tell people about this now, it doesn't matter. And the book came out as a hardback, and it was in the book. And then what happened is they came round to Tony Geraghty's house, and they said, we don't want you to put this book into paperback. Because what had happened in the interim was the anti-globalisation movement had just suddenly taken off, in the run-up to Seattle and all the rest of it. And this was before 9/11. And suddenly they didn't want the people in the anti-globalisation movement to know how they carried out their observations.
This is these environmentalists and
all these kind of people. And so... what they did is they said, we don't want you to go into paperback. And he said, well, look, I'm a journalist, you know. This is how I make my living. I want a paperback version of the book because I need to make a living. And what they said to him is, if you look in your computer, you'll see there's loads of child porn on your computer. And if you go into paperback, we'll dump this on you. You'll be accused of being a child pornographer. Anyway, I knew about this because he knew my father. And he was, because my father was a Liberal Democrat councillor, and he told my father about all of this. So what I did is I started going into the bookshop in Hereford and saying, can I have a paperback version of this book? And I made a big thing, I want the paperback version. Because, of course, he told them to go away, I'm going to have a paperback version. Yeah. And, of course, what was significant about it, eventually I got photocopies of the relevant chapter, and I took it to an anti-globalisation conference in London, and I gave it all to everybody there. You know, this is what they don't want you to know about. And, in fact, that's
Martin,
where I met... That's where
you
I,
naughty boy.
That's where I met Glenn from Exodus.
Wow, fantastic. Well, that's a nice little story to finish with. Even better is our poem of the week, which is, of course, dedicated to Nigel Farage. Much ado about Nigel. His swagger flash cuts quite a dash in speeches, promise folks more cash. With husky voice and rasp on chest, some hope in heart with teeth invest. Uniparty now on offence. Farage a threat from this day hence. Green, cons, libs, labs all had their day. Reform perhaps a better way. DEI, he says, must go. Or mass migration, Nige says no. Net zero, theft, another con. Woke culture, cancel, it must be gone. In crowds, Farage with shoulders rub, a ciggy pie or pint in pub, a head-to-head now Starmer's threat. Farage in pub with folks, laid bet. For Smarmer, no love is lost, is true. On ratchet, Greaves says, has no clue. No smashing gangs, free speech be gone, with human rights PM as one. Self-made folk, he says, are leaving. Reform for enterprise, conceiving, family, country, community, for married folk, tax, help, we'll see. On pensions, winter fuel won't rob. Meritocracy, brain drain, won't fob. Smarma, in Uriah Heep disguise, has sold us out before our eyes. The gloves are off, perverted truths, but on racists Nige fights nail and tooth. For our sovereignty he swears we'll fight. If choice be made, pray choice be right. From this orator with charm and grace, with much ado, may win this race. And he finishes perfectly with a quote from Farage. My vision is to put this country and the British people first, and for us to divorce ourselves from political union and re-engage with the rest of the world. So thank you very much for that, Patrizia. That's all we got time for this week. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guests. That is, well, obviously, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. But also to Emma Reynolds and Julius Abrahams earlier, and the pre-recorded guests, as well as, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored if you wish on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel and via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which will include the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, and the comment page. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter at thisweek.org.uk. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 a.m. and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live on the stream at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream this program live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Or not credit you here. If you wish, you can do it without telling me. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Please do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
That's right, I'm sad and blue, cause I can't do the boogaloo. I'm lost, can't do my thing, and that's why I sing. Gimme that thing.
Gimme that, gimme that, gimme that, gimme that.
Next door is such a dear old soul. Of children she has got a score. Her husband's on the dole. I don't know how she manages to keep that lot, I'm sure. I said to her today, she was standing at the door. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. Mrs. Moore, please don't have any more. The more you have, the more you'll want. They say a meet-up is as good as a feast any day. If you have any more, Mrs. Moore, you'll have to take the house next door. They're all right when they're here, but take my advice, oh dear. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. The little inn she uses most is called the Wooden Hat. She's first one in at opening time and last out when they're shut. And when she's had a few, she tries to do the la-di-da and get so ratty when they shout at her across the bar. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. Mrs. Moore, please don't have any more. The more you have, the more you'll want, they say, and enough is as good as a feast any day. If you have any more, Mrs. Moore, you'll never get to your street door. Too many double gins give the ladies double chins. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. She's had a lot of husbands who in love with her have fell. This one is the seventh one and he don't look too well. A year ago she married him and on their wedding day, as they were walking down the aisle, I heard the parson say, I don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. Mrs. Moore, please don't have any more. The more you have, the more you'll want, they say, and enough is as good as a feast any day. If you have any more, Mrs. Moore, I don't know what we'll do, I'm sure. Our cemetery is so small, there'll be no room for them all. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore. Mrs. Moore, please don't have any more. The more you have, the more you'll want, they say, and enough is as good as a feast any day. If you have any more, Mrs. Moore, I don't know what we'll do, I'm sure. Our cemetery's so small, there'll be no room for them all. Don't have any more, Mrs. Moore.